Let's start. Okay, so today we're talking about negligence in tort law, indemnity and contribution, and construction and design professional insurance. We'll go through each section, starting off with negligence in tort law. So you heard me mention before a tort. So what is a tort? A tort is, where it says here on the screen here, it's an act or omission. So something you fail to do can be a tort that gives rise to an injury or harm to another and amounts to a civil wrong in which the courts impose liability. So tort is civil as opposed to criminal, and then we'll show you some torts that also have a similar name if you're going to be charged with a criminal violation. So just because you've committed a tort doesn't mean you've committed a crime, but if you have committed a crime, very likely that's also a tort. Sometimes you hear about people that are in a lawsuit after maybe there's a conviction against someone, and then they end up suing that person because of intentional infliction of emotional distress or what have you. That's a civil action to recover money. So you'll often hear those going hand in hand, but it doesn't go the other way around. Like I said, just because you committed a tort doesn't mean you've committed a crime. It includes a duty owed socially and imposed by law to act in acceptable manner. So as we've said over and over in this class, the point of the law is predicting future, and it's giving people to understand how we all should act, and that's part of predicting future. We know we shouldn't be speeding. We know we shouldn't run through red lights. We know we shouldn't be reckless in how we act in walking down the street. And so, as simple as this, if you walk down the street and you run into somebody and there's intentionality to it, that's considered a battery. Now, if you bump into them by accident, that's a negligent, but you could cause injury. So a battery, which we'll show in a second, a battery is a tort, but if you didn't intend to, there's no intentionality, then it's just because you may have still hit somebody. Maybe you're walking down the street because it's really crowded, you hit somebody and they fell down and were injured, you've committed a tort. Now, is that recoverable? It depends on the circumstance. Could you have avoided this person? Is it reasonable to believe that because of how crowded it was when you bumped into them, that the other person may have been injured or they have been bumped themselves? There's all these things that factor into it. But the point of all this, in the second one, is it's a duty owed to society, everybody around us. And the law, and not the law, criminal law, but civil law, says we have to act a certain way. And ultimately, a jury is going to take a look at it and say, or judge, when you're in these cases where there's an injury, and say, did they act as what we think society should have done, and ultimately committed a tort such that there could be recovery in a lawsuit? So, we talk a lot about contracts, and we talk about a breach of contract. So what's the difference between a breach of contract, where there's an injury or loss because someone failed to do something, and maybe you owe them money because you were supposed to pay, you were supposed to do work for them, you didn't do the work, so maybe you owe them money, or some other type of issue where the contract dictates what your duties or obligations are, versus in a tort, there could be a loss. Like I said, you bump into somebody and they fall and they break their leg. What's the difference between the two? Well, a loss due to a breach of contract, as it says here, is determined by the obligations that's agreed to between the parties. So the contract defines what you're supposed to do versus society. Now, when we create contracts, and I've talked about, you know, you're like, well, didn't we talk about how contracts are predicting future and contracts are supposed to be reasonable and contracts are supposed to look to what society would expect? That is true. So the elements of torts, the beginning of those injuries and that concept of breach, give the basis for what the contract is, but the contract itself, oral or written, creates the agreement and the obligations between the two. So they're more, I guess you would say, defined. All the other elements between the difference between a contract and a tort in this sense is the contract is between specific parties. So if you fail to act to an obligation in a contract, and the other person that may be injured is not part of that other person can't sue you for breach of contract, but they could sue you for a tort, for negligence. I'll give you an example. So I'm an owner. I hire you as the architect to design me a house. You design the house, but you don't properly do a wall. The wall falls down. The example I use over and over and over. Okay, I have a breach of contract action against you as the architect because you failed to perform in accordance with the standard of care, which was in our contract, and that wall fell down. So the cost to me to erect that wall and put it back up, you owe me. That's my damages. That's my injury. But if a wall fell down and hurt a worker on the site, or hurt a passerby, or maybe it's after the building's up and running, and it falls down and it hurts somebody that's visiting the building, that individual has no contract with me, nor a contract with you as the architect. So that individual who has been injured cannot bring a breach of contract action against you or me, so they bring a civil action, which is a tort because they've been injured, and they bring it in negligence. So, the loss due to a tort is not a contract-based. Did you act negligently? So we're going to talk about what negligence is. So that's the elements of what you want to think about is when you talk about this concept of a tort from the high level. And then the overlap between negligence and contract, there is an overlap in that. And specifically for the construction industry, in the contract, any contract, and we'll get there next week and I'll show you in B101, there's language that talks about the standard of care. We talked a little bit about that last week. We're going to get into a little bit more this week about what the standard of care is. The standard of care is you are supposed to act as a reasonable architect performing work in a similar situation at a similar time. So your actions are based on this concept of negligence. And so if you breach the standard of care, if you fail to act in accordance with the standard of care, you have committed a tort. But what we end up doing is we put that paragraph into the contract and we write it out. And so we take this negligence concept and we put it in writing. And so when that failure happens and that wall falls down and you didn't design the wall properly, then the owner has the opportunity to sue you in breach of contract based on a negligence or tort theory. Does that make sense? Okay. What happened? Oh. My screen went weird for a second. Okay. Why do we have tort law? This is really quickly. We've done this a bunch of times. Promote safety, promote predictability in the behavior, and to allocate the risk of injury or loss. So we have to make sure. The last one probably we haven't talked about a lot. The first two we talked about, and it's continued like purpose of the law. To allocate the risk at loss or the injury. So we have to figure out who was at risk and what was the loss or injury. If you don't have that damage, remember in the breach of contract, you had to have all those elements, duty, breach of duty, causation, and then damage. If you don't have those four elements in the breach of contract action, you don't prevail in a breach of contract action. Similar concept we'll talk about here in torts. So you have to have that injury or loss, and the concept of tort law is to make sure we shift the loss to the party that's responsible. So if I'm walking down the street and I knock into someone and they fall down and break their leg, I'm the one that caused the injury, so the law says they're going to put the damage that the other person incurred, injury, loss, damage, whatever it might be, onto me. They allocate the risk. Okay. Now we're going to talk about, there's a couple different things here as far as torts. There are intentional torts, and then there's just basic negligence. Intentional is exactly what you think. Intentional torts are, I intended to do that. There was a mindset that you did this on purpose. And that's why it says here, the intentional torts can be civil or criminal. So let's take that example. I'm walking down the street, it's a crowded street, and I run into you. That, if I don't mean to do it, there's no intentionality to do that, that could be negligence. The reason why I say it could be negligence is let's say that it's a really crowded street, it's, you know, New Year's Eve in downtown Chicago, and the streets are crowded or whatever it might be, and I bump into you. That may not be negligence because I myself can't avoid the incident of knocking into you. And so they get into the concept of negligence. Is it reasonable to believe somebody? So part of the facts fall into it. So just because I've hit you and you've fallen down or injured doesn't mean that it's recoverable because is it my negligence? Did I really commit negligence or was it unavoidable? That's the first part on the negligence. But if it is less crowded and I'm just not paying attention, I'm looking at my phone and I run into you and you fall down, that's negligence, but not intentional. So we have the negligent tort and the intentional tort. Now, what kind of intentional torts do we have here? Well, these terms are stuff that is very similar to what you're going to hear in criminal law. Battery. Battery is when you physically strike somebody. You hear this, like the cop shows and everything, they talk about like somebody's been accused of assault and battery. So assault is when you put another person in fear of immediate harmful contact. I lunge towards you. I scream at you and say, I'm going to hit you. I act like I'm going to commit some type of furtherance. That's an assault when you say something like, I'm going to kick your ass or something. That's considered an assault, even if you don't go further and touch them. But if you do touch them and strike them, if you follow through with that threat or that putting them into fear of imminent harm, that actual striking of them is battery. Now, both of those have a criminal element to them. And you can be charged for a crime for assault and battery or just assault. But it also is a civil offense, too. So if someone is harassing you, bullying something, like we all hear about internet bullying and everything else, that can be considered the assault. And there's laws about that, that you can both criminally and civilly go after someone. So they fall under both sides of the law. Trespass. If you go on somebody's property, that normally is going to be considered just a tort. It's not going to, because there's really probably no damages that you're going to walk on somebody else's property. But if there's something that can physically harm or goes to the level, sometimes maybe you have been cited before for not being allowed to go on there and you break the law, or if it's a certain type of properties, governmental properties or other ways, and you go onto that property, that could be something where it's a legal action criminally against you as well for trespass. Conversion is taking or destroying another person's property. Stealing. Conversion is the tort word for theft or stealing. So if you actually take that, you have the same concept of conversion. And then there's false imprisonment, intentional infliction of emotional distress, defamation and libel. These are something that you also are considered torts. They're not as often considered criminal, but false imprisonment would be if you hold somebody, that's kidnapping. So you could be, let's say you were kidnapped by somebody, that's what we know is a crime, and then you ultimately are released. If they catch the party, you can sue the property, the person that was kidnapped, or their family can sue that individual or individuals that kidnapped you civilly for the monetary damages of the emotional distress. And that's the intentional infliction of emotional stress. That would be bullying. That would be what you may be doing to somebody when they're kidnapped or when they're in prison, softly in prison, those types of things where it's just emotional. It doesn't have to be physical. In the world of the law, you don't have to be physically harmed in order to recover either civilly or potentially criminally. And then the last one, defamation and libel, that's when you talk about somebody and you say things that aren't true, you spread discussions about people. Defamation or individuals, libel is going to be somebody that's in the public eye, but it's about saying things about people that aren't true. So those are all considered intentional torts, and you have to mean that. So when we get to courts, you have to prove that they intended to assault you. Most of the time, if they're going to make an action or lunging towards you and say something, it's fairly easy to prove. But the battery, when I ran into you on the street, it may not be intentional because it may be just that I'm negligent and just looking at my phone. So there's an intentionality that you have to prove to make it an intentional tort. And the reason why there's a difference between the negligent side and the intentional is you can, if it's a civil claim and you can prove the intentionality and one of these elements here of an intentional tort are proven, more likely than not, civilly, you'll probably recover more money. You're going to say they intentionally did that to me, and so it wasn't just by accident. So by accident, I have my own injuries, but when you intentionally did, those injuries can be compounded, and the jury will often award higher damages. So let's talk about, I keep talking about negligence. So negligence is the element that separates between, when you have a tort, between this intentional tort and just a normal tort. So negligence is causing a loss or injury by failing to act in accordance with the applicable level of care and caution. Again, society establishes for us how we want to act or walk or talk or what we're supposed to do. And so when we fail to act in accordance with that and we cause an injury or loss, now that injury or loss could be, again, just fearfulness. Let's say you have a situation where you have a crazy neighbor, okay? And the crazy neighbor is threatening you and saying things to you and acting very odd and doing things to you. They haven't necessarily done anything to you, but there is a fear, there's a loss that you have. That's the emotional distress of it. That could be the loss that occurs. Now, is it negligent? If they're screaming and going after you, that may be an intentional, an assault or a battery, if they physically touch you. But if they're acting in a way where someone's acting you like, I'm not even sure, then it could be negligence. If you're driving down the street and someone's driving too fast, and it puts you into fear for emotional stress because you see this, that could be a negligence. If they drive too fast and run into you in a car accident, they may not have been doing it on purpose to go after you as intentional, but they weren't acting with caution and care. And so that was them being negligence, running through a red light. All those types of things is considered negligence. There are different standards for different people in different professions. So we, as just the human race, all have our general standards of what's allowed and what we do when we walk around. Words that we say. You're going to find that our different countries allow different things. And things that happen in a different country, if they happen here, it may be considered not acceptable by society and vice versa. There's all different elements. So when you walk around as a person in the area where you are, that's what the people, the judge or jury, is going to determine to see whether your actions were caution and care and negligence. But if you're a professional, instead of just me walking around, if I'm a professional, I may have obligations. So as a doctor, what's a doctor going to do if they fall, see someone down and injured? Do I have an obligation because I know medicine to assist that person? And the answer, interestingly enough, is a side note, is no. There's a Good Samaritan law that protects you. It's not to say that a doctor shouldn't assist someone, but if they choose not to, they haven't violated their standard of care. But as soon as they do, if someone has fallen down, and I, not being a doctor, give that person, maybe they had a heart attack, and I give that person CPR, I'm going to be held to a different standard than if a doctor gave that person CPR. Let's say in both instances, the person who fell down and had a heart attack didn't live. They're going to look at the doctor whether the doctor was negligent in providing the CPR differently than me. And so it could be that if the patient does, if the injured individual doesn't live, but potentially could have, there would be no claim against me because I wasn't negligent. I was doing what I knew within my boundaries of a lawyer and a former architecture student. But if the doctor gave the CPR and the patient ended up dying, the doctor may be found liable because it was negligent, or he or she was negligent in the action they took. Does that make sense as far as difference between people and professions? And it's going to tie, when you're in your profession, they're going to look at you within the hats of what you wear of your profession. It's society-driven in many respects. Like I said, how are you supposed to act is who you are. Case law has helped establish the standard of care. So over and over and over, if you hear this standard over and over, and you talk about, this is how this person acts, this is how this person acts, this is how this person acts, eventually the case law is going to talk about what that standard of care is. And so when you get into a situation where there's a lawsuit and you write the briefs as lawyers trying to say why one person did violate the standard of care and the other side's going to say why they didn't, they're going to look at cases to talk about and support why their actions were not or were in violation of the standard of care or negligence, and so to speak. And then last, often the question of whether there's negligence is left to the trier of fact. I talked a little bit about that earlier, the trier of fact versus the trier of law. And depending on how your trial is set up, it could be if you have a jury, the jury's always going to be the trier of fact, and the judge will always be the trier of law. If it's a bench trial with just the judge is going to be both. And the trier of fact is what they're going to listen to the facts and take the society into consideration to see if you were negligent. Or the trier of law is going to say the evidence came in properly, or the law says you have to follow this, or what have you. So they're kind of the rule maker versus the trier of fact is listening to things and making a judgment or an assessment. Questions on that? So there are times, now I keep talking about trials where you have to prove things. there are times where negligence, you actually don't have to go through the elements. Remember, there's duty, breach of duty, those types of things. In fact, and there are specifically, if an action occurs, we know that there has been negligence. So what are those situations? So it's a violation of a law or valid regulation is considered to be automatically negligent. If you run a stoplight, we know that the stoplight, and there's a law in the books that says you can't go through a stoplight. If you go through the stoplight, no matter what you say, you are negligent. You don't have to prove. The other side who gets hit, the car that gets hit, does not have to prove that you committed negligence. That's already automatically assumed because the law, the regulation said you cannot do that. And it could be a criminal law or it could be a statute, which is a civil law. But if you violate something that everybody knows you are not supposed to do and it's written down somewhere, it's automatically considered negligence. Then you get into the other elements of causation and injury and damages and stuff to see if, in fact, something more should have happened or you can recover. But again, if it's there, it's considered automatically negligent. And the reason, again, is to ensure compliance with the law. If we didn't have to follow these rules and we could be negligent whatever we want and drive around and walk around and do whatever we want, then we wouldn't be able to have predictability of the future, there wouldn't be caution or care, wouldn't be safety for society. So it's about making sure we follow these regulations. And it's important in the court of law because, again, I don't have to prove that. I can say just by the fact that they ran a stoplight, negligence, one of my elements to recover on my lawsuit, has already been established. Negligent acts of an agent is automatically tied to the principle. So we talked about agency and principles last week, the law of agency. And so if your agent is out there acting negligently, the principle is responsible. Now, they're like, when we talk about where, you know, an agent is somebody that, you know, negotiates a movie contract or an agent is bidding at an auction, how can that be negligent or whatever? Well, here's another way to think about it. You hire me, my architectural firm, to design a building. And we design the building, and the building's under construction. And one of my employees, who may or may not be an owner of the company, but is the project architect, goes to the project site twice a month, just to make sure everything's going along and the building's being built in accordance with the contract documents. They are acting as my company's agent. That individual, on the way to the project, gets in a car accident. They're driving to the project. They get in a car accident and someone's injured. That individual who's injured can sue not only the driver of the car individually because they were driving negligently, but can also sue my company because the individual was acting in the course of business, going to the project site, and that agent's negligence is applicable back to me. So what ends up happening is like if I have my agents, or if there are people that work for me and they're driving around, it's very likely that my insurance, my automobile insurance for my company, will cover them driving. And so that's how I protect myself against that. So there are elements and there are pieces about that and other insurance. But you have to remember that it's not simply because I negotiated a bad contract for Scarlett Johansson or whoever I'm representing at the time. So, agency and apparent authority also, if the other side believes that the agent had authority and there's an injury, again, it can apply back to us, so there's negligence by that agent that has apparent authority. So, the person, especially in the car accident on the way to the job site, the person who's injured doesn't even know that that individual is an agent. They don't have any relationship with that individual. But again, that agency ties it back to me as the principal. So, and like, you'll hear this in lawsuits all the time. So there was one of my very good friends, this case probably made his beginning of his career. It's a tragic, tragic case. There was an injury and accident that happened on an old farm road out in the farmlands in Illinois. And the car was driving. It was a late, rainy night. And the car was driving, and they couldn't see the road very well. And what had happened was, a week before, there had been an accident with a trucking company. And the truck when it went off the side of the road, ran into a power line or a telephone pole, I'm not sure exactly what, and it hit the pole and broke it in a certain fashion, so it kind of bent. It was a wooden pole. And so it was there, and the wire that went over the highway kind of bowed down. But it didn't go down too far. But in this cold and rainy night, a week later, the winds and everything else, it went down further. It went down so far, and this is tragic about it, it sheared the top of the car off. And so my friend ended up representing the child who was in the back seat, the son, because the parents were killed. And so the truck driver was one of the parties that were brought into it, and the trucking company, because that truck driver was an agent of the trucking company, and so the recovery came from the trucking company. It's also the power company, because they didn't come out and repair it in time. But since the truck driver was the one that ran into it and caused that, they were truck driver's negligence. So the lawsuit was against the county, the electrical company, and the truck driving company. They didn't sue the truck driver because the truck drivers, as an agent of the company, made that negligence, the principal being the trucking company, responsible. So that's an example of an action that I specifically know about. Question?
Could they have sued the truck driver?
Yes, they could have sued the truck driver for negligence, but the reality is, and I think he was named, and he was in the depositions and everything else, but there was nothing to recover from him. You know, I mean, that you go after, the boy was awful because he had no parents and he witnessed what happened, and because it literally decapitated them in the car. It was tragic. It was awful. It was terrible. Went all the way up to the Illinois Supreme Court, too. He won in the trial court, won in the appellate court, and they went all the way up in the Supreme Court. But they just chose not to sue the individual because it wasn't relevant. But they had to pay for this guy. He was like 5 or 6 years old because he had to live the rest of his life. So anyway, we'll try to talk about more happy examples as I continue on. So, okay, negligence. When you have negligence, you have to have the elements, just like a breach of contract, because with a tort, in order to be a tort, there has to be negligence. It could be intentional or not. Breach of contract, you have to show the breach of contract. So what are our elements? Duty. Sounds similar. Duty is the existence of a standard of care or duty of care owed to others. Now, society creates the duty as opposed to the written words in the contract. So the jury will hear the arguments by the lawyers, and they will decide what the duty really is. And you're going to say, and you're going to see in cases where the party that's being charged as committing negligence will say, they won't go so far as to say, society doesn't demand this, but they'll say something like, is it reasonable to believe that my client should have acted this way that they're trying to say? Let's use the example of me walking down the crowded street and running into somebody. I get sued because the nice gentleman fell over, broke his leg, and can't go back to work and loses money, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I get sued for $500,000 or whatever the value is. The argument is going to be, is what was my duty to this individual? And that's going to be based on society as a whole. And it's going to be argued, both sides are going to say, I never breached my duty. Yes, I have a duty of care, but the street was so crowded, I was trying to figure out and I was jostling, and so I never breached that duty. So the concept of duty in a tort is not crystal clear all the time. In certain instances, it's very clear, especially if there's a law. But if it's squishy, like what happens in a crowded street when I run into somebody, it may not be so clear. If I was really trying to make sure that I was okay, I'm acting in accordance with duty society, but I still negligently run into them, that doesn't mean I've committed a tort. So that's an argument that will be made. But you have to have duty. The next one is, I breached the duty. I ran into somebody. I was supposed to be careful and not run into that person. When I did, I ran into them, I breached my duty of care to society as a whole. So same thing as the contract. If you have a duty written down, your society determines the duty. You breach the duty. You fail to act properly. And then you have causation. Is there a causal link, and this becomes the question, is there a causal link between my action and the injury? So was the thing that I did the thing that caused their injury? Could it be that when I'm walking down and I'm busy on the street and it's really crowded and I bump into them and they fall down and break their leg, could it be that possibly that individual was looking at their phone and not paying attention? And so when I ran into them, not only were they not looking up and they owe me that same duty of a standard of care, but they weren't taking care of themselves in a crowded street. They were looking at their phone and not paying attention. And when they fell, possibly their actions of not paying attention means that's why they fell. They didn't know where they were on the street, close to a curb. They didn't think about it. They weren't looking down. And so maybe I did bump into them, but the argument could be made in court had that individual been paying attention, my bumping into them wouldn't have caused the accident. And the jury has to decide, did I cause it or not? And you have to have that causal link. So causation becomes a very important element when you're trying to prove your case in a tort. It becomes more, the term I just used, squishy. I use that term, there was a client I had many, many years ago, and we were drafting contracts for him, and he's like, Mike, this is too clear. I want this part of this contract squishy. Lawyers don't like squishy. We like black and white. We like to see it. But he liked to say things were squishy because he wanted flexibility in his agreement. So we made his contract really squishy, and it ended up hurting him to the tune of about $10 million later on. That's a different story. But that's why I use it from time to time, because it helps in these types of situations. It's not clear. You know, when you start looking at the grays of causation, and that's another element, an area where you're going to have lots of arguments in the courts. When the lawyers are out there waving their arms and trying to impress you and teach you and tell you as a jury why you should find in favor of me or my clients, I'm going to be talking a lot about duty and I'm going to be talking a lot about causation. I'm going to try to tell the story such that A, they didn't breach this duty because this duty wasn't owed, or B, whatever happened didn't cause that. And you want to kind of think about that, because there may be some questions on the exam, but a lot of part of my exam, and let me just take a side note here. I will give you some examples, sample questions. I'm going to send those around separately, and we'll probably talk about them in the second part of the B101 to the first day, because I want to get a big chunk of it done on the first day. But I'll send those before, and you can kind of look at it. A lot of my exam questions are narratives, like a description of the story of something happened. And what I want you to do is kind of think. So there may be a question or two where there's a fact scenario that talks about a situation, and you may have to think about, was there a causal connection? Are there links between things? Was there a duty owed? Kind of putting those two together. And when we get to the pizza party and there's arguments, that's because I said, well, I'll do this. I'll listen to you guys. If you make a good argument to me about why you said it was this, and you can convince me like a jury, I'll give you the point. I like that part of this, and that's something that I offer to you guys. But that's, so some of my questions, I know that people are going to get wrong because they're going to think differently, but I want to hear that when we talk about it. So anyway, back to here. So causation, you have to have that causal link, that connection. Is it related? And then ultimately, you have to have damages. If there's no damages, there's no monetary damages, there's nothing to recover. You know, I wasn't physically injured. But where the damages can come into a lot of times is this intentional infliction of emotional stress. You know, are you fearful? Does it recover? Do you think about it over and over and over? You know, maybe you're in a car accident and you're not really damaged that much, or maybe there's no damage at all. Like sometimes you get hit and your bumper worked and nothing broke and you're not whiplash and everything else, but you have this fear. It just you saw that car coming to you and you don't sleep at night. There may be enough of that as a recovery for damages. But you have to have all four of these elements in order to recover on a negligence claim. Question on that? And damages, a lot of times, are monetary. Oh, hold on. Let me back up here. And I'll turn this down there just a second. A lot of times, damages are monetary, but sometimes damages, and you can actually get an injunction to stop somebody from doing something. So an example of that would be, let's say there's a bullying type situation. You can get an injunction against that person where there's a temporary restraining order or an order of protection, so that the individual who's the bullier cannot come within so many feet of the person that's been injured, bullied, even though there's no physical harm. So there may or may not be monetary damages, or that they're not allowed to talk to them, or there's the individual can't go on the internet. Maybe they take away their ability to go on social media. Those are types of things where that's the injury and the damage that you can recover from. So I didn't think it was going to go. I thought I had to press it twice, but this is a clip from, I think I told you guys in my first lecture, Mike Brady was the most famous architect in the world when I was in high school and going into college, and so that's why I wanted to be an architect, because he was the TV Brady, TV architect. So I have a clip from the Brady Bunch, the original series, and that's Mike Brady back here, and this is a court of law. This is a negligence action. So we'll see what can happen.
On the one hand, Mr. Gunn makes categorical that he looked very carefully before the motive car. On the other hand, Mrs. Brady confesses and says, if we, of course, establish the position entirely on the testimony of both witnesses.
So in this case, it was a parking accident between Mrs. Brady and this gentleman. She actually got her car damaged, and she said he pulled out, so there was a he said, she said in the court case. And so there's no lawyers here. They were putting that on what's called pro se, which you're allowed to represent yourself without a lawyer. But for the purposes of the Brady Bunch episode, they didn't want to bring in an extra actor or two. So they presented their case to the judge, and he always talked about how he hurt his, he had whiplash, and he couldn't do it. That was his injury, and he was trying to recover damages, medical damages, and the pain and suffering. And everybody knew that he was lying because they had seen him out with that, but he shows up in court with this big thing like that saying, I can't move, I can't move. So Mr. Brady throws the briefcase and we all see him move his head. And so there is no injury, there's no damage. And so even though it could have been that Mrs. Brady did actually back into him or not, and we don't find out in this sense, because there's no injury or damage, all that other stuff, whether it's duty, breach of duty, and causation, which all could have been proved potentially, we don't see that in the episode, since there's no damage, the court just throws the case out. There is no breach of contract, or there's no negligence here. There's nothing to recover. So, okay, standard of care. So we talked about that. I'm going to go through the standard of care. In general, and like I said, we can have standard of care for people and then professions. So in general, it's a duty to act as an ordinary, prudent, and reasonable person. So we're all just supposed to walk around and be what society tells us we should be. And as I said, different countries, there's different things. Different areas of the country, even in the United States, different areas of the country, and things are acceptable or not acceptable. Even when you're driving on a street, I will tell you this, and it's not the same now, but when I moved here, I grew up in the Detroit area, and I moved here in the, like, I started late 80s when I started law school. Detroit is a city of cars, as we know. There's no mass transportation, and people drive freaking fast. Like, if you don't drive on the highways in Michigan, this is back then, I don't know what it is now, because I'm not around as much, but if you didn't drive 80 miles an hour, you were getting passed all the time. And when I came to Illinois, I think Illinois is a lot faster than it used to be. When I came to Illinois, I was passing people because people, I thought, drove very slowly. In both instances, we were breaking the law because the law at the time was, I don't know if it was 55 or 60 or whatever the miles per hour was. But I found that society in Michigan had us driving faster, whereas society here had us driving slower. So that's, and again, if we break the law and you're arrested and you get a speeding ticket, you have already committed negligence because you violated that law. But let's say there's a car accident or whatever, maybe those come into play. Maybe they don't. But it's something that you want to think about. Even within from state to state, there are different elements that decide if you're acting as an ordinary, prudent person. So, it's applicable to everybody, and then different standards for different people in different professions. So we talked a little bit about that with doctors, lawyers, and stuff like that. Interestingly enough, people with mental and physical handicaps are still required to act in accordance with the standard of care in which a reasonable person who is not handicapped would observe. So, and I would expect, but I don't know when the jury's going to be hearing a case where there's the accused, the defendant, the person that supposedly was negligent, was handicapped physically or mentally. I can't imagine the jury not taking that into consideration. But the law, as case law has come down, and it's possibly shifted over the years because I think we're luckily much more attuned to people that have physical or mental deficiencies, and so that, or handicaps, it's not a deficiency, it's a handicap, that we take that into consideration better, I think, as a society now. But by and large, the law says simply because you are handicapped doesn't mean you don't have to act prudently. So if I'm somebody that has, and I have a friend of mine from high school who was injured in a military accident, and so he's paralyzed from the waist down. He has a special car to drive that he uses his hands for the braking and for the acceleration. Well, he still has to follow the rules like all of us. Just because his legs don't work properly, he still, and we are used to driving with our legs, or speeding and braking with our legs, that doesn't mean that he doesn't have to follow them simply because he doesn't have the use of his legs. So that's where it's going to stay the same. Now, maybe if there's a situation where had you had the use of your facilities both mentally and or physically, you may have been able to react differently. Maybe there's going to be a little bit of a leeway there. But even that, if you know you're in a situation where you maybe have a mental impairment, maybe you shouldn't have put yourself in that situation. So there's those types of things that will come in. Generally, the law is going to say your standard of care is going to be applied across the board as the same type of people. And again, the whole point is predictability. You, as the other person, the person who ultimately got in the car accident or was walking down the street or whatever, don't know that the individual that you're seeing there may or may not be handicapped or mentally or physically. So you are expecting them to act in a normal way. As an example, possibly, let's say that there's someone who, trying to think of a good one. Let's say there's an individual who is highly reactive to noises and sounds, okay? So we're in a situation in an area, maybe you're in a small room where people are talking and everything else, and a loud sound can cause this individual to react, and maybe react in a very violent manner. Maybe somebody's autistic. And there's a loud boom from something outside that's unrelated. That person may reach out, may strike you. But you don't even know that. You're not expecting that. And so the law will still say, did this individual put themselves in a bad situation? Was it reasonably foreseeable that this loud boom would happen? All these types of things will come into whether that individual committed a tort by hitting you following that reaction. But the courts will look at it through the eyes of both you, because you're not expecting it, you look at people as just people are people, and them as what is their handicap and what's the situation. Questions on that? Okay. And then, people with greater than average levels of ability or skill are held to a higher standard of care. Doctors, lawyers, accountants, and everything else, because we are trained to act in a certain way. So society looks to us as to act a certain way. So like when you call me to ask me to be your lawyer, you're not going to call me because you have a product liability case. You're going to call me if you have a construction issue or an architectural issue because I'm trained in that area. I can give you some advice on a product liability. I practiced it 100 years ago and I can give you a little bit. The first thing I'm going to say to you is that's not my area of law. I have a partner that can work with you on that. So even within professions, there's going to be specialties because that's what you should be expecting me to give you, that higher level of care, that higher level of skill. And as a result, if I violate those, I can't say, well, I just didn't know about construction law, so it wasn't negligence. In fact, I have to be held to that standard. Question?
The higher skilled people being held to a higher standard, is that only related to, like, a licensure?
No. I mean, you can be someone that's trained in, let's say, I have a good friend who's, he does assistance a lot of times. Like, he goes, he's at every Chicago Marathon because he's taken some classes in CPR and helping people out and like things like that. So he has some training, but he's not certified as any, he's not a paramedic, he's not a doctor, he's a sales guy. but he knows a lot about that stuff, and he got trained in that. So his training and volunteering for this, they ask, he had to fill out a form, he has to fill out a form to go and do that. And so they accept him and bring him in, and so then he gets assigned to work on an area, and there's been some people that he's actually helped over the years of the marathon. He will be held to a higher standard of care because of his training. He has no certification. But you have to have that education. You have to have that training to get you to that higher level. If I wouldn't volunteer at the same tent where they were helping people out, I'd be like, tell me what to do. You know, I'll be ready there with a bottle of water or whatever, and I'm going to be the novice. And so, and other than the probably 20-minute lecture they're going to give me, if something goes wrong with a person that passes out on the in the marathon, they're not going to come after me, or they're not going to hold me to the same standard of care as my friend does, because he has training for that. So, question? Yeah, sure.
First, so, like, in that example, like, I've taken CPR training, I've been, like, CPR certified in the past.
Yes.
Am I still considered, like, to the higher care that I have had this knowledge before, or since that, like, certification has expired, I don't have that anymore?
So I would say the answer is I can't give you 100%, but what's going to happen is, let's say that somebody fell down and had a heart attack. You remember your CPR training from when, like, I had CPR training because I was a lifeguard. I swam in my high school and college, and I lifeguarded in the summer, so it was the greatest job in the world. You just spin a whistle and do that. Although I'll tell you a story about somebody in a second. But my CPR was 45, 50 years ago. Like, I know how to do it, but, and so if I went and did that, would I be held negligent if the person passed away? If I'm a crafty lawyer on the other side, and I'm going to ask, have you ever had CPR training and everything else in the discovery part of it, and I have to truthfully say yes, that crafty lawyer is going to try to convince the jury that he knew CPR and he failed to do that. But my lawyer's going to say that was CPR training 50 years ago, and that was something that he attempted, but he shouldn't be held to the standard of a professional. So in that type of situation, somebody may try to do something with it if it gets so far as a court, but you shouldn't, in my opinion, and I would be the average Joe or Jane on a jury, should not be held to the standard of care if somebody is certified. Second question.
Second question, kind of going a different route. At what point in, like, our career do we become held to that standard?
Like in the professional cares of architects?
Yeah.
That's a great question. I think, certainly if you become licensed, you're going to be held to standard of care of every licensed architect out there. But there's going to be, like, I don't remember the statistics, but I want to say, when I looked at it last, less than 50% of the people that graduate from architecture school and become a practicing architect actually get licensed. They don't necessarily need it, they can do it, they, you know. And so, does that mean that you're not licensed? Would you be held to the standard of care? Probably. And this is no offense because I say it to, I was one myself. Like, when I first started practicing law, I was called a baby lawyer. When you're a baby architect, you shouldn't be held to the standard if someone's been doing this for so long. And so what's going to happen is the firm that you work for should be having a mentor with you to make sure that the firm protects you and everything else. But that question is going to be my favorite two words. It depends. It's just going to depend on how long you've been out, what the situation was, what you should or shouldn't have known. All those things will come into it. So, but the quick story I was going to tell you about, so I had four kids that I had to pull out of the water during my lifeguarding career. Do you guys ever remember, you ever heard of the show Saved by the Bell? So the original, because they had a remake of it, the original, so there was Tiffany Amber Thiessen, I can't remember the other people, Zach somebody or whatever, I think maybe Zach was his character, but the tall girl was Elizabeth Berkeley. I saved her when she was 11. So she grew up in my area, and I lifeguarded at a theater school. She would take summer camp as a theater school, and it was a pool and everything else. She was just a girl out there, and I was the lifeguard. And I think she got kicked by someone. And I won't really say I saved her, but I had to go in and get her. She got kicked by somebody, and she was flashing, and she kind of went under. And so I had to bring her out. And I knew her name, because back then I knew, because I had to write up a report what happened and everything else. And then years later, I'm like, oh my God, that's Elizabeth Berkeley. That's the girl I pulled out of the pool. So it's my one little story about standards of care and what you're held to as a lifeguard and CPR. So, any other questions on that? Okay. Reasonableness. Now, this is where we get into this concept of what's the duty and the causation. The reasonableness of the person's action is a matter of proof, and that's the jury hearing the fact, the trier fact of what it is. So So we hear they determine whether the ordinary reasonable person should behave, and if the defendant, that's the person who committed the injury, the person that's being sued or claimed that they committed the injury, did they live up to that standard? When I was walking down the street and I ran into somebody, if it's a wide open street, and I wasn't paying attention because I'm on my phone, I didn't live up to the standard of care. If it's a really crowded street and I'm trying to avoid people, maybe I did. That's what the reasonableness of my actions come into play. So you have to look at that. That's one of the things, and there may be some questions on the exam where you have to think about, did this person act reasonably and such that they committed a violation of the standard of care? And that goes to both professionals and non-professionals too. So you could say that the architect may have failed to design something properly or do something properly. It normally comes into less about the design and more about when you're on the site where you have to observe things. And I'll give you an example of a case that I had. But this is really applicable to the second part here. Jurors may not be aware of the appropriate standard of care. They're not going to know what necessarily a reasonable architect or a reasonable doctor or a reasonable accountant should have done, or a reasonable person. And so we have to, in court, one of the things we do is we have to educate the jury. And in fact, sometimes you have to educate the judge, too. A lot of judges think they know everything because they're judges. But maybe they don't. Maybe you have to explain to them why this specific incident was not a violation of the standard of care. And it's established, like I said, through a subject matter expert testifying on how a party should act. So you're going to get an expert up there. That expert's going to say, I'm an architect. I've been an architect for 35 years. I design condos and high-rises, and this is what they should have and how they should have acted in accordance with that standard of care. This was the standard that they should have done. On my reasonable story, so I represented an architect who designed a series of townhomes in Chicago. So like, you know, the three-story walk-ups that everybody sees, and it's like a block, a row of them, and this was a very big complex. They were actually one of the best and most well-known architects for these types of developments back in the 80s and 90s. They did, like, they were one of the tops in the cities. Everybody went to them. But lots of the developments you see around the city, these big condo, or probably just condos, less apartments, but these three-story, four-story walk-ups with a bunch of them are all touching and everything else, were designed by this company. And so they were engaged by a building company as opposed to a developer that just says, I have a property, I want to put up a bunch of condos, and then that person sells those all. Sometimes it's a builder. So this builder, different than a developer, that's what they do. They have their own construction crew and everything else. They retained my client to design this apartment, this condo complex. And again, it was the three-story walk-ups. But because they were a builder, they took my client's drawings and deviated from them in multiple different ways because they knew how to do it faster, better, cheaper. So they thought. What ended up happening was is where they changed how my client designed the building, it ultimately resulted in mold accumulating in the structures. And so there was, I don't know, I think 190 buildings, 190 condos that were part of the complex. They had built about 100 of them. People had moved in. There was really bad mold up and down in the walls and everything else. And the reason why was in this flat story, this flat roof, between the ceiling of the third floor, the bedroom, and the actual roof is a space. They call it what's called an interstitial space. It's like an attic, but it's not an attic because it's only about 20 inches, 18 to, maybe sometimes it's up to 2 feet, but it's a space that's in there. And that's to create what's called a vapor barrier between the outside and the inside. Because if you just had snow coming on your roof and right into the first floor, you know, then you would have cold and you have condensation on your roofs. So you have to have that space. The way my client had designed it is structurally, because they had to span this, they had a bunch of open trusses to allow the air to flow between this whole space. And even if it's considered a flat roof, there's actually, by law, it has to be a certain low pitch to allow water to drain. Because if you just had it completely flat, water would just stay there all the time, and then it would deteriorate and it would start leaking. So you have this slight pitch. And the concept was is that both ends of the building, there were vents. And because there's a slight pitch, and because the air could flow through, it would circulate air in there. and that would allow air to go out, and so that space could be cold from the outside during the winter or hot during the summer, and it wouldn't affect what's below in the house. Well, the builder could get what's called glue lamps, which is a beam that's solid as opposed to the truss system. And so each building had two of these trusses structurally to port, so it created three separate sections. The builder, because it was cheaper, put in solid trusses, solid glue lamps. That didn't allow the air to flow. So each, during the off seasons, hot and cold, when moisture would develop because of condensation, that moisture would stay there and then it would go down the walls and create the mold. So that was the damage. That was the claim. They had to rip out all these condos. They had to pay for a lot of people that were living to move somewhere else. Big lawsuit. Millions of dollars because of all this mold and all the costs they had to do. And they said that our client breached the duty. We didn't build it. And we said, you didn't even build it the way we designed it. So we didn't do anything. Like, how can you say that we did something wrong when you changed the design? We didn't breach our duty. You failed to act as a contractor and as the owner to follow our plans. That's your obligation. So they came back with their second theory. And their second theory was, but you were out on the project site. You should have seen that we deviated and told us that we shouldn't have built it that way. Now, the question is, was it reasonable for my client during the times that they were on the project site to have seen the change in the structural situation? And the answer was, interestingly, had we been somebody that was a normal architect coming out either monthly or twice a month, which happens in most projects, the architect comes out on a fairly regular interval, had that happened, it would have been reasonable to argue that we should have seen it. Because we would have seen the building in all different construction phases, including when they're putting up the glue lamps. But the contract, because this contractor, developer, builder, didn't want to pay for this service because they knew better than us, wrote in the contract that said, site observation will only be when we ask you to come out. And so there was about a 6-month period of time before we were asked once and then came out a second time. And during that period of time, they had closed all the ceilings with drywall, so we never saw the interstitial space on any of the properties. And so we argued that it wasn't reasonable for us to know that. So that's where even, you don't even have to get to the duty, breach of duty, everything else, you're saying, how could we see? None of us have X-ray vision. So that was the argument that we made. So that's where reasonableness. The prior fact, in this case, was an arbitration panel. They're the ones that say, should they or should they not have seen it? Should they have said something or not something? They came back and said, we shouldn't have said something. We didn't have to say something. It's not we shouldn't have, but we didn't have to because we didn't know. So that's a situation where reasonableness, is it reasonable, comes into the arguments in court. Questions on that? A little bit more on standard of care. Reasonable person's actions is a matter of proof. We gave proof of what happened, again, determined by the jury. Sometimes the plaintiff can avoid proving. This is a situation where you avoid proving. Remember when they said there's this negligence, this automatic negligence, you don't have to prove the duty and the breach of duty because it happened? The doctrine of the law is called res ipsa loquitur. My kids are like, they take Latin. My son took Latin for like 9 years, so he probably knows what it means, but I looked it up. It says the thing speaks for itself. There's a lot of Latin in law. So whatever happened, it just speaks for itself. So the plaintiff, you normally, again, this goes back to this violation. If you violate a law or regulation, it's res ipsa loquitur. It's automatically considered negligence. You've already committed a violation of the standard of care. But let's say there's no law or regulation. Let's say there's not something out there that you can point to that says, oh, they ran a red light. So we know there's a regulation that says you can't run a light. Can we have something that's not clearly defined? And that's where res ipsa loquitur goes into the issue of just when it's not in a regulation. So the duty, breach, and causation are all inferred from the injury that not would have occurred. So I have down here, here's my example. The scalpel was left behind. You hear these cases where somebody sues the doctor and then they show an X-ray and there's a sponge still in their stomach or whatever. But we know that person had a surgery just because the sponge is there. There's no law that says, although you would think there was, but there's probably no written law that says don't leave a sponge in a patient when you're doing abdominal surgery. I'm sure that's not written down somewhere. But because that sponge is there, We know that they had a duty to not leave it there, and we know that there was a breach of duty because it's there, and we know that the sponge is causing injury, so there's a causation. So that's all res ipsa loquitur. So we have this situation where this is similar to what I was talking about. It's automatically considered negligence. This is automatically considered a breach of the standard of care by that professional. I'm trying to think one in architecture. I mean, if you're designing a colonnade per se, and you have certain regular amounts of spaces between the columns, but you want this kind of grand opening space, and you fail to put columns in a space that span this too long, and they build it, and there's a sagging, you could argue that that's res ipsa loquitur, that because you failed to put that in, that the curvature of the beam above and the breaking and cracking of the stone or the drywall, whatever it is, that's what we see. We know it's because you failed to put additional structural support in there. That could be argued as a res ipsa loquitur. It is what it is. You committed a breach of the standard of care. So that's an example of construction. Questions on that? There's not going to be a res ipsa loquitur question on the exam, just so you know, but I wanted you to understand that it exists. Professional standard of care. The professional person, so instead of just the normal, the professional, it's a person whose occupation requires sufficient skill and judgment. Doctor, lawyer, architect, accountant, even contractors that are licensed. You know, you don't have to be, and you don't necessarily, again, have to be licensed. Like we talked about, by one of your questions was, if you have that knowledge and maybe you have some training, you can be held to that standard. But you can look at the second part here, and this comes also into the standard of care. Doctors don't guarantee cures, so it's not, I have to do everything perfect. Lawyers can't guarantee acquittals or winning a trial. I've lost some cases. I've won, luckily, more than I've lost, but I never guarantee anybody. And when I have a case where I think it's going to be a problem, I encourage my client to settle. I can get you more. We can go to trial and roll the dice, but I probably can get you here, and at least you walk away with something, and we stop the bleeding and legal fees and everything else. So I give them advice, but I'm not going to ever say, we're going to win this case. I never say that to any client. Architects can't guarantee the design is 100% perfect. I mean, when you guys draw your drawings, when you prepare drawings for any building, there are hundreds, probably thousands of areas that you don't draw up. You draw one window detail. Maybe there's 1,000 different windows on the building, but you draw one window detail. Hopefully that window detail is good because it's going to be repeated, but you can't do everything. When you're walking on the project site, you are never going to see everything. Even in my kid's situation where we couldn't see behind the walls, maybe there's times when the walls are still open and you miss stuff. So you, as an architect, never guarantee and never warrant anything. And that's actually a big thing in the law. If you ever get a contract that uses the word I warrant, I guarantee, I represent, strike that. That's as an architect. Contractors warrant, guarantee, and represent. Architects say I will perform to the standard of care. When you see those words, those are bad words. And the reason why you want to strike that is because your insurance policy, probably somewhere in 4.5, says, we will never insure you if you warrant, guarantee, or represent. So, if their contract says that, and you've given a warranty to the other side, and then there's a lawsuit, you call up your insurance company, and they read the contract, and they're like, you're on your own, because I'm not going to cover you for that. So it's really, really important for architects. We don't guarantee anything. As I said, the construction contractor does warrant. They say it's going to be good. Now, there's a standard to the level of what they warrant. Everything needs to be new unless stated otherwise. So if they're putting in old used doors or windows, that's a violation because they warranted it's going to be new. It's going to be done in a good and workmanlike manner or whatever else they've warranted. So in many ways, the contractor's held to a higher standard than an architect, but it's in a different area. It's for construction as opposed to design. Does that make sense? The professional standard of care, and this is what you're going to see, this is kind of the magic language, and we'll talk about it next week. It's in Article 2.2 of V101. The professional standard of care is the level of skill and care on which an ordinary person of the profession would observe under similar circumstances at the same time and location. So you just have to be an ordinary architect. You don't have to be the super architect. You don't have to be the best architect. Although, I have seen contracts both sent to me where I strike it, or my client, when I represent an architect, has signed it, where the language says, we will provide the best skill of an architect. Now, because that word best is put in, you actually have to be held to the standard of the best architect, not just an ordinary architect. So that's another buzzword to be careful about when you look at your architectural contract. The best, the highest, those are words you want to also strike, because we may think we're the best, but we're not. The best architects out there still make mistakes, so let them be ordinary architects. Did you have a question?
Yes.
You have created a higher standard. I will be held. I'm going to provide the best architectural services out there. And when I fail, I can't say all these architects, 9 out of 10, 4 out of 5 architects surveyed would have done this, 9 out of 10, whatever they do. I can't say that. I have to say 9 out of 10 of the best architects in my area wouldn't do this. So I'm held to a higher standard of care because it says best.
Because it's stated in the contract.
Yeah. If you have an oral agreement and you don't talk about that, then you're going to get the normal standard of care. But once the contract puts that in, that you have now changed the traditional standard of care and elevated it because you agreed to a term in writing. So
I'm just wondering, how does that refer to the scale, like the specific scale of the...
That's a great question. Is there a scale to who, what's bad, good, better, best? There isn't. And that's going to be the argument that both sides are going to make to try to show reasonableness. What is considered reasonable? Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, what's considered reasonable is the best architect. I mean, is it the best architect to design houses, or is it the best architect to design nuclear power plants? And what do we have to do with that? That's the one that's trying to make the jury confused and try to take that word out of the equation. And the other side, that one that was representing the party that's been damaged or injured, is going to say, here are the best architects and what they would do. Here's my expert who's considered one of the preeminent experts on this area in the country, and here's what he would have done. And he didn't, and this individual didn't do it. Yet, contractually, they were supposed to do it, and my guy that you just heard on the stand, or these people that you've talked about and we put information in, they are the best, and they never would have done that. They breached their contract. So that's how, you know, I'm going to try to smoke in the ears and try to get out of the best if I'm defending you, and I'm going to try to laser in on that element when I'm the other side. So, but, yeah, sure. It's a breach of contract. That's a great question. So we've been talking about negligence and tort all day. But it's a breach of contract when you write it in the contract. That's where it gets confusing, and I apologize if I've kind of mixed something up in this. So most architects that are going to be performing services are going to enter in some type of contract. Could be oral. Most likely it's going to be written. So once you enter into that agreement, that standard of care, which is a negligence standard, it's a standard of care that's, if you don't follow that standard of care at the bottom of the screen, you are a negligent architect. So it's a negligence standard. And if you fail to do that, you've committed potentially a tort. But I take that negligence standard, that standard of care, in writing. And as soon as I put it in writing in the contract, it's still the same proofs that I have to show that I violated that standard of care, so I was not acting as a normal, ordinary architect. But contractually, I'm now obligated. So when you sue me for breach of contract, and there are different evidentiary rules that come in and different things about why the word best was put in there. If it's, sometimes you're going to have an architectural agreement that has no standard of care written into it. I wouldn't advise that, but if it's there, if it's silent, you get the ordinary standard, and nobody could ever make you be best. But as soon as that written word has the best in it, that's now contractually obligated. So the only way I can get you for that is I sue you because you breached the contract. Because the ordinary standard, which is what's generally out there, doesn't include best. So the contract breaches the best part. The standard of care is already built in, and it's written in the contract. Does that help? Okay. Any other questions on this? Typically, expert witnesses are from the same profession and are required to prove applicable standard of care. I did have a case, though, once where we ended up settling it, so it never made it to trial. But we got this expert. It had to do with a bunch of pumps. There was pumps in a wastewater treatment facility where it was in a city out in the western part of the state, and all the waste and refuse that came from your houses and everything would go through it, and it would process the sludge and stuff. So it's kind of nasty stuff is what you're thinking about, but the smells and everything else. But so when the water would go through a series of filtrations and different sizes of filters, and eventually would make it into a vat, and the vat would then be spun to allow there to be settlement of the different levels of the whatever still the sediment that's still in the water or whatever the sludge is. And a pump would then eventually pump it out, and the pump would help it spin and then ultimately pump it out. We represented the pump manufacturer. The pump manufacturer, it kept, every time they operated the system, these weird vibrations would happen and the pump would fail. And then it would break. And so we sent out a new pump. And that would fail and break. And so after the third or fourth pump that we sent out for free and installed and everything else, they ultimately sued us. And they came in and they designed a whole new system, and it was a betterment issue, and they went from the Chevy to the Rolls Royce. They put in the best system, completely different design. But they sued us, and one of the things they said was that because our pump fails. And we explained to them that the failure had to do with the harmonics and the vibration. It wasn't our pump, but there was a vibration harmonics that would cause this thing for pieces in the support structure of this vat to fail and rupture. And that then ultimately damaged our pump. That was our argument that we were not liable. Our pump was working fine. It was the rest of the design. Well, they ended up hiring, they brought in the engineer that designed a new system, and he opined, because he was an engineer and had designed wastewater treatment systems, he opined that our pump was a failure because of A, B, and C. And so we brought in a pump expert like this gentleman, and we brought in a harmonics gentleman, expert. And the harmonics expert went in and talked about all the reasons why the harmonics didn't work properly. And then this expert, the other side, tried to counter that and talk about harmonics. And so in the course of the deposition, I asked him, have you ever taken any classes on vibration? And he said no. Have you ever given any opinions on vibrations? He said no. Have you ever read any treatises or written any treatises on vibration? No. And there was many, many other questions about that. But all of these were designed to say, you cannot opine on vibration. It didn't mean that his arguments about the pump and being an expert about the pump didn't survive. It didn't mean that our guy and his guy were still not going to, we're going to battle against whether it was the right pump or not. But we removed him from being able to opine about the vibrations, because even though he was the same profession, in the same area, pumps and wastewater treatment facilities, he didn't have that specific element for harmonics and vibration. So we ended up settling the case before we went to trial, but that's one way you can take even somebody that you think is the specialist and separate them out. So, the professional's appropriate standard of care is generally beyond the ken or the understanding of a jury. The jury's not going to understand, like, I've worked on nuclear power plants, I've worked on, like I said, pumps, I've worked on, there's so many things I've worked. The average jury is, and frankly, the average judge isn't going to understand all these nuances. So they need someone, the expert, to explain what that standard of care is. And sometimes you're going to get these people. There was a guy, really, he was a phenomenal expert in the construction industry. He was an architect. And testified over and over and over. I won't say his name. Because after a while, everybody, if you had a case with him, you just knew this guy was like a hitman. He was going to come in. He was like the best of the best. He would say whatever you needed him to say. But he was so smooth in the way he delivered and everything else. But he knew his stuff. And so his cases predominantly did very well. And he stopped practicing architecture because he made a living as an expert witness because he's really good at it. And I've been on the other side of him. I never hired him. I've been on the other side where I'm like, I don't want to hire you because you're so far into your career that you're going to say whatever the plaintiff wants you to say. So I don't want to be on your side. But sometimes that happens. So you can, there. But his job was so good at explaining to the jury. Sometimes, though, a layman can determine certain professional conduct. So that goes to your question, do you have to be certified or anything else? We had a guy, we had a third expert in this very same case, and he was an installer of pumps. So he didn't know anything about harmonics, he didn't know anything about pumps, but he knew how about, he was an installer and he worked with these types of vats all the time. We had him testify. And he had done some testing where he was just running it just as normal as they're supposed to operate. And he testified that he said, I think it had to do with this. So he was a layman, but he had training and test and background in history. So he didn't have any, no certifications, no degrees. He was just a guy that had worked in the industry for 35 years. He became an expert for us. So you can have a non-professional testify as an expert. So the qualification as an expert, we have experts in quote here, is to determine whether he or she can opine on the relevant standard of care. So sometimes, even in court, you will have a hearing where the judge, not the jury, because the jury doesn't want, you don't want the jury to hear the facts, will have a hearing just to see if the expert that's being offered to testify, before they even testify about the case, has the qualifications. In federal court, it's called a Daubert hearing. That's based on a Daubert case. But what happens is, I offer an expert, and the other side says, I don't think that expert's qualified to talk about the situation. So we want a hearing to prove that they have enough training and background to be able to testify to that. So the judge will have a specific hearing. Lots of questions about what's your history, what's your training, what have you done, how many times have you opined, how many times you this and this and that, to establish whether you are actually expert in this field. One last thing on, one last thing about experts that I will say, and this goes to the concept of the paid hitman. I had a case back, that's probably been 15, 20 years now, where, and I will not take any credit for all the work that was done to get us there, but there was an expert on the other side. It had to do with the slope of a roof and drainage and some issues, and we represented the company that did the pre-engineered steel that built the structure, and I was working in conjunction with the contractor who erected our steel and built the rest of the building. And there was an expert that testified for the owner of the building that talked about the slope of the roof and the way these elements of the construction came together. And he was really good. He took his deposition. He was very clear. He was very impressive. And so I was like, this guy's going to be tough. He's a good expert too, but this guy's good, really good. And he makes sense. He spoke common words, common language. He's like, this is going to be tough. It's going to be a bench trial, but still. My co-defendant, the attorney that was representing the contractor, he did some history research, and he researched and he found some cases where this engineer had testified in other cases. And he found a case where it was written, that the facts were written, was actually went up on appeal. And his testimony from his trial was in the case. And he took, for the exact same scenario, this is like one in a million that ever happens, for the exact same situation of the slope of the roof and the issues that we were dealing with, he took a 180 degree opposite opinion, because he was representing in that time the builder as opposed to the owner. So we knew this, and we had this discussion, and we were talking about it when we were deposing him whether we should bring it up, and my co-defendant, the attorney's like, no, let's wait. We don't know if we're going to trial or not. Let's wait and see what happens. Maybe we settle the case. We end up going to trial. And again, I give all the credit in the world to my co-defendant. He said, you take this witness, Mike. I had the architectural engineering background, so I spoke the language a little bit better. I'm like, no, you did all the homework for this. Because it was like served up on a silver platter. And he's like, no, you do it. So it was like one of the most fun cross-examinations I ever had. I got him up there, and I had his deposition testimony where he said A, B, and C in favor of his client at the trial. I'm like, you were at this deposition, and you said the following. Yes, you were asked this, and you answered this. So I had the actual transcript. I'm like, you're asked this question, you give this answer. Is that correct? Yes. You asked this question, you give this answer. Correct. So it's all how evidence comes in. So he's like, every time he says yes, I'm locking it into him. I'm like, so that's your opinion, yes. And that's what you say happened here. And then I said to him, I'm like, do you remember case X, Y, and Z in which you were hired as an expert? And I just saw his face kind of go blank. And I'm like, do you remember that case? He's like, nah, kind of, maybe. I do so many cases, you can see him kind of stammering. And I'm like, well, this case actually had to be reported. And so I'm going to ask you a few more questions just that. Do you remember in that case being asked this question, given this answer? Oh, I don't remember that. Ask this question, given this answer. I don't remember that. Ask this question, given this answer. I don't remember that. And so at the end of it, it was, like I said, 180 degrees. It was devastating to the case. And so we took a break. I don't know if it was the end of the day or at lunch. And we filed for what's called a motion for directed verdict, where you say, it doesn't matter what they say, we win the case, because their expert lied on the stand. He had 180 degree from the exact same scenario. And the court ended up awarding us, and so the case was tossed out. It was one of the coolest things. Like, and again, I give all credit to my co-defendant for finding all this, but it was the most fun cross-examination I ever had, because I was able to like put him into this little box and then show him that he then showed the judge that he was lying, and then he just kind of sat there squirming on the stand. It was very much like you see on TV. You never have that. It was the only time in my entire career I had that. But it was fun. So, experts aren't always the best. Sometimes they're just paid to say what they say. Sometimes they're all very good. Okay. Yeah, I don't want to take down experts, by the way. So, they're most of the time they're really good, but occasionally you get one. All right. Second element, breach of duty. Again, just like in contracts. Defendant's conduct violated his or her duty. The conduct fell short or falls below the standard of care. You just didn't do what you were supposed to do, whether it's a normal human being or professional or whatever you are. And again, it's the reasonable person test. We're the reasonable ordinary architect, the reasonable ordinary doctor, the reasonable ordinary person walking down a crowded street, the reasonable ordinary person walking down a non-crowded street. That's going to be taken into consideration. And then the conduct was a dereliction of that duty imposed. The duty that's imposed on me. I, as walking down the street, have a duty. I, as an architect, have a duty. I, as a lawyer, have a duty. So that duty is imposed on me, and I was in dereliction of that duty. Pretty simple on breach. Is the defendant an expert or if the defendant is an expert or professional, standard of care is tied to the expectation of such expert or professional. I've talked about it enough. I don't need to go into more of that. But that's it's a different standard. So, causation, the third element. The injured party must prove the defendant, the accused, breached the standard of care was the proximate cause of the injury. There was a causal connection. Proximate cause is both the actual cause and the not too distant in the causal chain. So, if I'm walking on the street and I bump into you and you keep walking, and then you fall a block later, yes, I committed a tort. Yes, I bumped into you. Yes, I could have knocked you over. And maybe, if you can prove, a block later you were still dizzy because I pitched you in the jar or something, maybe you can make that causal connection. But if it's too far removed in time or space, then that causal connection chain may have been broken. So you have to keep things together when you're proving that case, that causal link. The plaintiff does not have to show that the defendant's conduct was the only cause of the injury. So when that wall falls down and hurts the electricians putting in installing conduit at that wall, and that wall falls down, maybe it's the architect that designed it improperly, maybe it's the contractor that built it improperly. Maybe in my situation where there was the interstitial space, we know the contractor violated the drawings, and so we know the contractor was a cause of the mold. Was my failure to see that approximate cause? Maybe if I was on site once a week, it could be that I saw it. I even talked to the contractor about it, and we said it was okay. Both parties could still be liable. So the causal connection doesn't have to be just one individual or one act. It can be multiples. And then the plaintiff's claim is sufficient or one of the causes results in the injury. Let's say in that same situation where the interstitial space happens and the builder, let's say it wasn't the builder here who was both the builder and the owner. Let's say the owner just decided only to sue the architect. I would try to point my finger at the contractor and say they contributed it because they violated my drawings. But the owner doesn't have to sue both of them, or the party doesn't have to sue both of them. You can just go after one. So that goes to your question. if I'm the architect and I commit something wrong or whatever, should I be the one sued? Or if I'm the person that hasn't done CPR for a long time, or like my client that, or my friend that decided not to sue the truck driver. You don't have to sue everybody that has a causal connection. There are going to be reasons. Sometimes, and I've had this in cases, sometimes you sue a party, maybe you sue both the architect and the contractor. And then as the case goes on, you find out that if you continue to sue the architect, their evidence will be damaging to your case against the contractor. So maybe you get rid of that party, so you can only focus on one. Now there's risk to that, because they'll point to the empty chair, but there are tactical reasons, or monetary reasons. There are various reasons of why you don't necessarily sue all of the entities that caused the injury. And simply because you don't sue all the entities that caused the injury doesn't mean that the injured party doesn't still recover. Question?
Is there anything wrong with the lawyer of the architect explaining that situation to avoid the flex being sued towards the contractor?
So the architect explains to the client, or the owner, the lawyer explains to the client, let's say the owner suing the architect and the contractor.
Mm-hmm.
And then the lawyers, as the case is going on, because they're hearing day by day and the depositions and everything else, the lawyer starts hearing testimony from the architect that may be harmful to my client.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the architect says, oh, your client was out all the time and knew all this construction, and your client was directing traffic, and your client was telling people to do stuff that I wouldn't have done, but since it's the client, it's their property, that's what they did. And that testimony starts coming in. I don't want the judge or jury to hear that testimony, so I talk to my client and I say, they could hurt our case because they're pointing fingers at you as much as they're pointing fingers at the contractor. Am I in trouble? Have I committed violation for saying that to the client? Is that your question? Is that?
I guess you're acting as the lawyer, the client's lawyer.
The client's lawyer, yes.
I was asking more of the architect's lawyer letting the client's lawyer know that if this information came out, it would be down.
Oh, okay. Okay, yeah. Okay, I see what you're saying. Okay, good. That's a good question, too. Let me finish on mine.
Yeah.
So me telling my client, the owner, that there could be damaging evidence coming in if we keep the architect, that actually is my duty, because it's hurting his or her case. But in this situation, let's say the architect knows something, the architect's lawyer knows something, and I have a relationship with the architect's lawyer, and we're on a conversation, and the architect's lawyer says, Mike, you know, if that comes in, that might not be the best thing for your case. Is the architect's lawyer committing a violation? The answer is no, because that architect's lawyer is also looking at the exposure to the architect and the money that that architect is going to pay for legal fees. I had that happen in a case in the last 2 years, 3 years, where we ended up, I had a very candid conversation with the architect, and I said, if we call your client to the stand on this, are they going to go this direction or that direction? That direction being bad for us. He's like, and his response was, Mike, I wouldn't call him on the stand. That's what he said to me. I said, okay. And that was part of the discussion. He didn't say this or that. He didn't get any more. He could have. But he's like, Mike, I just wouldn't. And I had taken the architect's deposition. I'd known a lot about what the architect had done. And I kind of had this feeling, but I had a good relationship with his attorney. He's like, I wouldn't call him. And so that was part of my discussion with my client. And we ended up settling with the architect and then proceeding on. So that can happen. And I don't think in that situation, again, the architect's, the lawyer's duty to the client as a professional is what's the language that we have to, our standard of care is to represent the client with the utmost zeal. That's in our model rules. We have actually rules that are written that establish our standard of care. And utmost zeal says you are doing everything to make sure you protect your client. In a situation where there's a breach of contract, it's going to be a monetary recovery. You have to take into consideration how much money your client may have. Sometimes clients don't have enough of their own money, so they only are relying on the insurance company. But if that money runs out, let's say you have a $1 million policy and you get a $3 million verdict. Well, the insurance company writes a $1 million check and says, see you, and then you go bankrupt. So there's all those things that factor into that zealous advocacy of your client. So, okay, let's continue on. Where are we here? The test of whether the cause is proximate or whether the results were reasonably foreseeable. That's that question that we get to the jury. Is it reasonable that this would have happened? But if the black and white case and the wall falls down and the design was wrong, the jury's easy. Yes, it's reasonable that they should design a wall that shouldn't fall down. But in the situation where I'm walking down the crowded street, was it reasonable how I acted when I bumped into this person or not? Or is it reasonable when the architect was walking on the project site, did they see the glue rams versus the trusses? Is it reasonable in the course of the type of design, was that reasonably foreseeable to cause that? Lots of things come into it. So that's one of the questions that the trier of fact will look at. The reasonable foreseeability that the causation connects the dots. If that person could show that I bumped into when I hit their head or their jaw, that it caused them dizziness and they were trying to recover, and they could show that when they fell 10 feet or 20 feet later, but not immediately, that it was caused by me, the jury's going to say, is it reasonable if I only hit them in the side? Probably not. But if I hit them in the head, then it's reasonable that that injury caused the ultimate fall and breaking the leg at a later point. That's sometimes the reasonableness can expand or create time longer than what you might say. It doesn't have to be immediate, but that's the proof on that is on the injured party, that the other side didn't act reasonably. Questions?
In your situation as the builder and your client, where they switched out the...
The glue lamp?
Yeah. The glue lamp. Was that ever documented to your client that they were going to make that switch?
That is an excellent question. And the answer is no, it was never documented to my client. This was such a unique relationship where the most of the time the client isn't a builder themselves, but in this case it was, and they were a builder of many, many subdivisions and many, many complexes and everything else. So they had their own design department, they had their own people doing stuff. And so the normal contracts have a requirement where drawings go back and forth. It's request for information. If I see a drawing and I'm not sure it's what I want to do, I send a request for information as the builder to the architect. The architect says, oh, here's your solution, and there's a paperwork going back and forth. Or if there's a change, a field change, that's documented somewhere. That's normally what happens. It didn't exist in this project, and that's one of the problems. And as a lawyer, I would make sure and say to my client, probably did at the time, you should have had a contract where they had to document changes, but it didn't happen. So that was one of the things that actually came up in the trial, or the arbitration, was what information did you have? And we had no information about that, so it came to reasonableness. But that's a really good question. Okay, next one, damage. Oh, more causation, sorry. The but-for test. So the but-for test is, again, this kind of falls into the res ipsa loquitur a little bit. But for the defendant's negligent act, would the plaintiff have suffered injury or damage? So you have to, that's how you want to think about that causation, that proximate cause. So the causal chain may be broken by a superseding act. So sometimes you can have, maybe I did actually hit them and crack their head or whatever it is, and that person was dizzy. Sometimes, though, there could be a superseding act between that. An act by someone else between the tort, original tort, and later, after the defendant's breach, which also is extraordinary and unforeseeable, and it breaks that causal chain. I don't know if I have any examples of here. Criminal acts or intentional torts of third parties will break the chain unless they are reasonably foreseeable to occur as a result of the defendant's actions, a foreseeable act of God. So let's say, here's an example of a foreseeable act of God. Let's say I designed a wall that was not proper, but there's this huge 100-year wind that comes in and knocks the wall down. Well, it probably would have knocked the wall down if I had designed it properly anyway. I committed a tort, I was negligent. I didn't commit a tort, but I was negligent. The tort would have been if somebody was injured. But I was negligent. I didn't work to the standard of care in my design of that wall. But if you can prove that that wall would have fallen over no matter what, because it was this hurricane force wind or whatever, that's a superseding act that takes the liability potentially away from me. They would have to prove that if it was designed properly, it would have withstood this wind. So that becomes that what's reasonably foreseeable, but you can have that intervening act that takes away from the fact that you caused the injury. I'm trying to think of any other examples where that would happen. It happens more often than you would think, but nothing's coming to mind right now. But that's also a defense that you would say. There's this intervening, superseding act. I mean, maybe if the if the action, again, taking as an example where I ran into somebody in the street, maybe the person is kind of staggering a little bit because they lost their footing and they bump into somebody else and that somebody else elbows them off the street. Yes, I caused the initial injury to cause the person to stagger and they ran into somebody else. Well, that somebody else been pushing them into the street actually committed an intentional tort. That's a battery by putting harm to the body. But that was a intervening act. Without that act, that person wouldn't have fallen into the street potentially and broken their leg. So that's where you could have a causal chain break for that scenario load injury. Okay, now damages. Damages are intended to compensate the injured party for all the injuries suffered. So most of the time it's monetary, but again, sometimes we talked about injunctions last week or 2 weeks ago. Examples of category of damages, traditional tort claim. I've lost wages. I can't go to work. I've lost wages. Cost to repair a placement of the damage to the property. We have to still rebuild that wall, so there's cost of that. Pain and suffering. Got a broken leg. I have pain, I'm walking around, I can't do what I normally do, I have to miss my kids' baseball game, practice, whatever it might be. Those are all things that come in. Loss of consortium between you and your spouse or whatever. So there's lots of things. Or it doesn't even have to be your spouse. You lost the consortium of being able to spend time with your family or your friends. So that's where we get into these. That's the type of damages that you say. And those, because of case law, have become recoverable by financial gain. Particularly in personal injury cases, damages can be many millions of dollars. So that's something that we've all read about, cases where somebody gets awarded, you know, $5 million, $10 million, hundreds of millions of dollars for an injury. There was a case many, many years ago, a Texas case where a woman got burned by coffee from McDonald's. It was a huge verdict. It was in high 90s, low 100s. It was a huge, huge number. I talk about this in every class, and like 4 or 5 years ago, I got a letter from an email from an architect who was listening to my lectures to study for the ARES, and she actually had been a paralegal at a law firm for this case, and she corrected my recitation of the fact because I had told it incorrectly. So I'm not going to go into the details because I don't remember exactly what, because I know I was saying it. It wasn't a major thing, but it was more about how the damages had been reallocated. But that was millions of dollars because this poor woman got burnt by the temperature of the coffee at McDonald's. And they argued it was reasonably foreseeable that someone driving out of the drive-thru could fall and it could burn on their hands. So that's how they won the case. And then defendants in major buildings can be cost of hundreds of thousands of millions of dollars to repair. You know, construction's expensive, so it doesn't have to be a personal injury. It could be a construction claim. It could be a delay. Your design, we had to redesign this area, and as a result, it delayed my project. And it delayed that I had to pay these workers to sit around while we redid stuff. So not only do you owe me money for rebuilding that area, that wall, whatever it is that you designed improperly, but I have to pay for all these contractors to sit around and wait. So I have delay damages that I have to pay. That's all different types of monetary damages you can prove. Any questions on those elements? Okay. Plaintiff owed negligence. So sometimes if you yourself cause the negligence, if you are part of that yourself, that could affect whether you could recover. You know, if I'm walking down the street and I step off the curb and it doesn't have the walk sign and I get hit by a car, I am part of that fault because I wasn't paying attention. Am I all part of it? Is it 100% me? Well, that becomes a question. So under the old rule, this is going back what was eye for an eye, tooth for tooth type one concept, was called contributory negligence. In that sense, if you had any involvement in the negligence, if you had any involvement in your injury, I stepped off the curb just an inch and I got hit because somebody was swerving and coming at me. They weren't in the lane, they were coming at me because they were falling asleep at the wheel or whatever. But I stepped out enough to put myself in danger. The old rule is you would never recover. Sometimes they had percentages and stuff, but like there are a few states, Alaska, Maryland, North Carolina, Virginia, D.C., where if you only have 1% of the fault, you don't recover at all, which is pretty harsh. Because like I said, yeah, I stepped off the curb, but that guy was coming at me because I fell asleep at the wheel. Who's really at fault there? Both of us, but is it really something that I should take the blame for, because had they been driving straight in the lane, I never would have been hit. So the new rule, which most states do, is what's called comparative negligence. They do a comparison, a balancing. And the comparative negligence sometimes has the 50% rule, or 51. I think Hawaii, was it Hawaii? Hawaii is 51, you have to get to 51%. But if it's 50.01 that you are at fault, then arguably you don't recover. But you're 49, you can recover. But then the jury looks at it and says, if it's $1 million you're asking for, then they only award you $501,000 because you're 49%. They can allocate based on your percentages of contribution. So it's comparative is better. They try to balance and weigh who's at fault. But then you get into these arguments of percentages, and then more experts come into who's greater or less, and it becomes, again, a difficulty for the juries to figure those things out. That's it on negligence and standard of care. Now, we'll have some questions on standard of care and negligence on the exam. I'm going to go through contribution and indemnity. Probably won't have anything. There may be one question on it, just as a general concept, but it's very important for your profession, so I always talk about it. So I can't promise you there's not going to be anything on this, but it's going to be like, if it comes on, I'm going to try to make it very high level for you guys to understand it and everything else, because this is an area of law that becomes very confusing. I have lots of clients, architects or contractors or owners, that have negotiated hundreds of contracts themselves. And when they get to the indemnity clause, they always send it to me. They're like, you figure this indemnity out. So, what is indemnity? Indemnity is a contractual obligation, other than in Pennsylvania, where it's actually by statute, but contractual obligation of one party, that's the indemnifier, somebody indemnifying you, to compensate the loss or injury to the other party, the person who you're giving indemnity, due to acts of the indemnitor or a third party. Like, what the hell does that mean? Well, I'll try to make it really simple. When we're to leave it in construction, and this is all I want you to understand from this slide at all. I'm an owner, and you're a contractor. You have a subcontractor that's putting up the electrical in my house. Somebody comes over to my house, they flip the switch, and they get electrocuted. Maybe not dead, but they have a numbing in their arm. Okay? The electrician obviously didn't do something right. So the electrician breached a contract with the contractor, because I only have an agreement with the contractor. But the party that's injured doesn't have an agreement with anybody. But they came over, and it was my house, so they sue me. I get sued by the person that's injured. They don't know who built my house. They don't know who the electrician is or anything. They just know when they came to the house, they flipped the switch and they got their arm shocked and they're numb. It's a valid claim against me. It's a tort. They were injured. There's a proximate cause. There's a duty that my house shouldn't do that. There's a breach of those duties. All those things, they're coming after me for the tort. But my contract with the contractor says, you, contractor, will indemnify me for this third-party loss. So what I do is, because I didn't build the house and I didn't install it, I look to the contractor and I say, you must indemnify me, you must cover me. Sometimes it's both legal fees and for the injury, because you promised me that you or anybody that was working for you would do their job. So it's a third-party injury, the person coming over, sues the first party, me, and I go to the second party. Remember we had that... Oh, you guys didn't see it. I got to get you that Harpo Groucho Marx one. We'll do that after the break of the third party, first party, second party. But if the third party, the injured party, has no contract with us, sues me in tort, and I look to my contractual partner, the contractor, and say, you pick this up. You indemnified me, even though you haven't been sued. So I sue them for indemnification, breach of indemnity, breach of contract. So they, when the jury comes down and says, yes, the value of that numb arm, this person can't do their business, maybe they were an artist. So it's their whole livelihood. Maybe it's a $10 million lawsuit because they lost the use of their arm. It's not a small one. I look to the contractor to indemnify me, and I don't pay the contractor has to pay. That's the concept. It's an agreement between two parties. Has to be contractual, except for I think in Pennsylvania where they have it statutorily, but only in Illinois. So it's a contractually written agreement for indemnification, and a third party over here gets injured and only sues one party, and you look to the other one and say, you promised me you'd take care of me for this. That's indemnification. That's about all I want you to understand. We're going to go through a little bit more, but that's where you want to understand at this level of where we are for this. I mean, I'm going to talk about a couple more things, but it's important to you guys to understand that. At least when you're talking about it with your boss or a lawyer or anything else. But I remember Hanahan telling me that indemnification talks about a third party being injured and we promise we'd indemnify the owner, or somebody promised they'd indemnify us, whatever it is. So contractually, we can look to each other to pick up whatever those damages are for the third party. Okay. Indemnification is a security against a loss, hurt, or damage. So you, I, the owner who hired you as the contractor, I get the security that you will take care of me because some third party got a loss or an injury. Compensation for damages or loss sustained. Because when the jury comes back because they only sued me, I will have to write the check because I'm the only party being sued. But if I look to the contractor to indemnify me, then the contractor writes me the check and then writes the check to, I take that check and write it to the third party. Sometimes, if you get everybody in the case, you can try to, and we'll talk about that in contribution in a second, you can get the party, the check directly from the contractor to the third party injury. But that's how the process works, is it's supposed to flow through me, because the promise was made to me, so I could take care of, to make sure that the compensation for the loss. So there's a third party claims and not first party claims. First party claims are between me and my contractor. I'm a first party to them, they're a first party to me because we're in contract. So I can't sue the contractor for its breach of contract and indemnification. I have to sue when there's a third party damage. So, and that's where things get complicated. You don't have to understand that as much. Construction and a hold harmless clause. You're going to see this word hold harmless in a contract. That's the indemnifying. I'm going to hold you harmless, me the owner. Contractor promises that if I, contractor, screwed up, I'm going to hold the owner harmless to pay the third party. I will pay the third party because the owner is being held harmless, didn't do anything. And again, it's a risk-shifting allocation. Why should I? Yes, I own the property. I probably should keep it up. Maybe if I had a little spark earlier, I should have called something. But if that never happened, it was the first time it ever happened, I wouldn't know. That would be part of the case. But the party, the injured party coming to my house expects my house to be safe. That's why they sue me. So I'm shifting the risk to the contractor who installed the electrical part as opposed to me carrying that because I'm not an electrician. And the reason why it's contractual is because you have to kind of establish the rules of what you're indemnifying for. There's very long paragraphs and it's very complicated about what how the indemnity works and what is in and out. It has to do with insurance provisions and all that stuff you don't need to worry about. But that's why you want a contractual, is to make sure contractor and owner know what the obligations are in writing clearly when that third party gets injured. Do you have a question?
Is there typically a period of time after which indemnity is no longer applicable? Because if the person gets shot 10 years after the electrical gets installed, is that...
So that's a great question. And so the question comes down to a statute of limitations type thing, and it has to do sometimes with the language in the contract. So traditionally, indemnity is a provision and that normally will survive the end of the project and continue on. Now, sometimes you'll have language that says this provision is only good for the next 3 years, and it may be tied to how long your insurance policy is in place. Sometimes you may have a provision that specifically says indemnity survives the termination of the contract period and it goes forever. But then when that injury occurs, let's say the injury occurred, let's say 11 years later, well, you would have a defense because you built it and 10 years has gone by, so nobody discovered it until year 11. So even though you have a duty to indemnify me, you have a defense because it's outside the statute of limitation. But I, as the owner, still have to pick it up then. I can't look to you because it's outside of the statute. So there are some time constraints depending on the situation. But it's traditionally, it's not going to end just right when the project's over. So, That's a great question. I've never had that asked. Even in my case law, I've never had that asked. So that's a good one. Contribution. Okay, we're talking about this concept of contribution. Contribution kind of often goes hand in hand with indemnity, but not always. It's very similar. They're kind of like almost look-alike cousins, or that older brother, younger brother, that are really, they look almost exactly alike, but they're not quite twins. They walk hand in hand, indemnity and contribution. Contribution is a method by which a defendant brings a third party in, but not the injured third party. So that's where it gets a little confusing. To the trial, to reimburse the defendant for that percentage of the party's damages, plaintiff's damages, but really the fault of the third party. So the concept of indemnity. Remember, I have this agreement between me and my contractor for indemnification, okay? Contractor says, Mike, I promise you that if you get sued for something that I did wrong by someone, a third party over here, I promise I'll pick it up. That's my indemnity. I don't have a contract with the subcontractor. Let's say my general contractor's gone out of business, but the subcontractor, the electrician, is the one that actually screwed up. I don't have indemnity necessarily with them. Maybe I do. Maybe they have it in their clause, but maybe they don't. So that person gets injured by the electrical switch, and I'm sitting there going, I didn't put the electrician in, and my contractor's gone. He's bankrupt. There's nothing there. I have an action under Illinois law in most states for contribution. It's statutorily, it's created by statute. And I can sue that electrician in contribution to come into the case. And they then are like indemnifying me. It's not quite as clear, but they stand and they contributed to it. So the judgment comes against me, the third party that's injured by the electrician, for the electrical spark. Judgment comes against me. And then I say, I prove to the court that this is the party that caused the fault, they contributed to it, and as a result of that, they need to be in the case, and they need to pick up the costs. And to your question about timing, there's actually a 2-year statute of when you have to bring somebody in for contribution, because it's not a contract claim, but if I bring somebody in for indemnity, I have the 4-year plus new or should have known. I have a longer time because indemnity is a contractual obligation between me and the contractor. But since I'm not suing the contractor, I'm suing somebody I have no contract with, contribution, I have to bring them in within 2 years. Let's go to my scenario where we're walking down the street and I run into somebody and that person falls and breaks their leg. But it was that second scenario where I bumped into them and they kept going and kind of staggered because they lost their effect and they bumped into somebody else and that was the person that caused the injury. But maybe it wasn't so far as breaking the causal chain. I can sue that other party in for contribution. There was no tort between that party and me, the one that bumped and put them into the street. There was no connection. There's no contract between them and us. They didn't touch me. I never had anything to do with them. But they contributed to it. So I get sued by the person that broke their leg because I hit them first. I bring a contribution claim against the party that hit them second. Both to try to create a break of the causal connection, but also to say, maybe that $1 million loss with a broken leg and couldn't go to work, maybe it needs to be split 50-50 or 60-40 or 70-30 between me and the contributing party. So you can bring somebody in through this creative statute called contribution, but there's a limit to how much and what time. Question? Can the third party, meaning the one that was in contribution, yeah, they would counterclaim as a contribution action back to me. They would say, you, it's not me, it's you. So there would be this action going on between us. We would have counterclaims against me and the other party that I brought in under contribution. We would have a fight here. And the third party, the woman that got injured that I bumped into, would be just suing me. And then the court and the judge and the jury, however it goes, would have to sort out at the end who's at fault and who's this, and the jury would have a form and they take percentages, or maybe this woman was looking at their phone, so there's a percentage there. I bumped harder than the other one, so there's a percentage there, and so they do balancing of all that other stuff. So that's how the jury form goes out. So yes. The party that bumped into the injured party, so the second bumper, I'd be bumper one and bumper two, they are contributing party, they're suing contribution because they contributed to the injury of the injured person. Does that make sense? Okay. There will be no contribution questions on the exam, but I needed you to understand that, because it's important. And then the same as contribution, except the third party becomes liable to reimburse the defendant for all of the plaintiff's damages, because you can say 100% there, and it's a contractual obligation. Blah, 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 blah. Let's see if there's anything more you want to need about this. Okay, we can kind of go through that, because I'm going too long. Any party can make a promise in a contract to indemnity the other party for a certain specified consequences, but it has to be contractual. So subcontractors, and when I talk about the action against the subcontractor, most of the time when I as an owner create a contract, I tell the contractor, every one of your subcontractors must indemnify me as well. You try to pass that downstream. So that's why sometimes subcontractors will promise to indemnify the general contractors if the claim resides. So the subcontractor may indemnify the general, the subcontractor may indemnify me, they may indemnify the architect. So we try to get this indemnity that's going to get everybody into the same cauldron, same bucket. Contractors often promise to indemnify owners and architects against claims filed against those owners and architects arising out of the general contractor's work. That's that concept that with the general contractor isn't brought into the lawsuit, but the owner gets sued or the architect gets sued, so you have to bring the right parties in under indemnification. Most states, Illinois. Oh, this last one actually is kind of important too. This last one's probably a good one for you guys to remember this. Most states, like including Illinois, have passed statutes that says you cannot and are not allowed to indemnify someone for their own negligence. So I'm an owner, and I go to visit my project site. It's after work. I go in to see my house being built or whatever. Wandered around, I moved some stuff around because I want to see behind some walls or whatever, and I create an unsafe space. Contractor comes back to work the next day, their electrician goes in, he starts working in an area, and this whatever I did, moved some wood or some lumber, it falls on them and hits their head. I have committed negligence as the owner. I never should have done that. I get sued by the injured worker. This thing fell on my head. He gets his worker's comp from his client or from his employer, but he sues me. I look to the contractor and say, "You need to indemnify me." And it turns out, during the course of discovery, they find out that I moved some stuff. The contractor does not have to indemnify me, meaning they don't have to pay if I was negligent. So we get the $1 million verdict. And I say, pay $1 million, contractor. And they say, no, you had negligence in there. I'm not going to pay for yours, even though I indemnify you for that third party. You were part of the problem. So I'm only going to pay for my share. That's what normally happens. So you don't have to indemnify someone for their own negligence. That's something we want to make sure when you're in negotiating a contract. And again, this is where you want to call your lawyer. But you want to make sure that if there's an indemnification clause, you as the architect, this is one thing, you should remember this last one. Make sure there's a provision that specifically says, I, architect, will not indemnify you for your own negligence. You have to take care of that. Because if it's not written in there, and there's no statute, I think Minnesota doesn't have a statute, then you actually have to indemnify them. Even if they screw up. Some states are. Even if the owner screws up, or the other party screws up, if it's not written into the contract, you have to pay for their screw-ups. Which is not fair, but that's why you want it in your contract. So that one of all the stuff of this takeaway for your agreements, make sure you have this last bullet there. This talks about derivative liability. I'm going to just skip through this. It just talks about the people, employer, employee, derivative. It derives from someone else, but we don't need to worry about that. Okay, last part. Let's see what time is it here. It's a little longer. Insurance and types of insurance. So I'm going to go through some insurance. There's going to be... there will be a few questions on insurance, but not like really in-depth questions. So I just want you to understand what we're dealing with, the types of insurance that you have to have. But they're all relevant for your practice, so I'm going to go through it. So the first and most important for the architects is professional liability insurance. I've talked about this before, often called errors and omissions. This is for you as an architect, for your services in design work or observation when you're on your project site, when you're actually doing your job as an architect. This coverage is for claims of negligent errors or omissions. So if you are negligent, you have insurance. Just like if you're driving a car and you do run that stoplight, or you whatever happens, you get into an accident and you were negligent because of that, your insurance is going to pay. That's what happens for E&O insurance. Okay? The key concepts, there's a limit. There's a coverage limit. $1 million. The typical things you're going to see in an architectural firm is you're going to carry $1 million, $3 million, $5 million, and then it goes to 10 and maybe 25. But normally most architectural practices carry between $1 and $5 million of insurance. And that is the maximum that the policy will pay on account of a claim. So to carry a $3 million policy, judgment comes down for $4.5 million. Insurance company writes a check for $3 million, and I, as the company, have to pick up the $1.5 million. So back to the earlier question about, is it wrong for the architect's attorney to advise and tell somebody on the other side something to do to get them out of the case? I've had cases where the architect's exposure, let's say that the architect's insurance was $3 million. The architect's exposure was around there. Could have been higher, could have been lower, but around there. And so they would advise their client to settle for policy, just pay what you have, because the risk could be that you get hit higher or you spend all this money in legal fees and there's not $3 million left in the policy. So that's where the attorney gives both legal advice on the defenses they have in the case and a monetary advice on business practice. You should just get out of this case because it's going to hurt your business, because it could be more than your policy's valued at. E&O policies are what's called declining balance policies. So there are two types of insurance policies. One is the value of the limit. The other, declining balance. Declining balance means is this. I have a $3 million policy. We hire a lawyer. The lawyer charges, over the course of the case, $1 million. The policy now only is valued at $2 million, because the million, the insurance company is paying the lawyer. So it's only valued at $2 million. It goes down by all the costs and expenses related in the lawsuit. That's a declining balance. The other type of policy is if it's a $3 million policy, no matter how much the lawyer gets paid, it's worth $3 million. And we'll talk about that in a second. But all professional liability policies that I know of are declining balances, or eroding policies is another word, that it erodes the value and goes down. And that's when you have to talk to your client. Say, at the end of this case, you're going to spend $1 million. You got $3 million in coverage. That means there's only $2 million left to cover the claim. Maybe it's a $4 million loss. You should get out. Pay quickly so you don't have to pick up the difference between 2 and 4 versus just pay 3 and you go away. So that's business as opposed to just legal. Deductible. Deductible is like any insurance company. You pay a deductible. There's a certain amount you have to pay for yourself. Sometimes the deductible is paid at the very end. Sometimes you pay the deductible at the beginning to the insurance company, but it's a value that you, no matter what the policy is worth, you have to pay for it. So let's say it's $1 million policy and you have a $100,000 deductible and you don't have to pay that to the end, the insurance company is only ever ultimately going to write a check for $900,000, because that $100,000 deductible is your responsibility. Retroactive date. So if the insurance policy goes into place on January 1st, the accident takes place in July of that year, most policies are a year long, then you're within with that insurance coverage. And maybe in January you went from $1 million to $3 million because you saw that your business was getting bigger and the risks were more. But let's say that that injury didn't happen in the calendar year of 26. Let's say it happened in November of 25 when you were only carrying $1 million of policy. Which one applies? Do you apply the $3 million policy that you're carrying in January because that's when you have at the time when you're sued? Or do you apply the $1 million policy because that's when the incident occurred? How many people think It should be the $1 million policy because the accident happened in 2025. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Okay, by 5 or 6. How many think it should be the current policy they have even though the accident happened in 2025? A couple more. How many people don't know? Probably everybody. So the answer is, and this is another thing that's interesting about it, I don't know if it's my next button here. No, premium. It'll be the next page. The answer is, it's what's called a claims-made policy for professional liability. This is the other unique difference between a professional liability policy and your traditional insurance policy. When the claim is made, that is the insurance that's in place at the time covers. Somebody gets injured in November of 25. You don't get sued until July of 26. It's the 26 policy because it's a claims made policy. It's when that claim was made. The injury is retroactive to 25, but the policy that's in place when the claim is made is what's used. So the unique thing, the two big things I want you to pull away from this, the two unique elements of a professional liability policy, which covers your negligence as an architect, is one, it's an eroding or declining balance, so it's never going to be 100% of it because they're paying the lawyer. And two, it's a claims made. When the claim is made, that's the policy in place at the very time. Those are the two biggest things to take away, at least from this class. There's a lot more on coverage insurance you don't have to worry about, but that's what's important for you guys to understand in coverage for an architect on professional liability insurance. Deductibles are large. Like, I've seen deductibles that are $1 million, but that may be on a $25 million policy. If you've got a $1 million policy, maybe your deductible is $50,000. If you've got $3 million, your deductible is somewhere between $100,000 and $250,000. It just depends on what the company is, what your risk profiles are, all that stuff. The insurance has tables and negotiations and everything else. So you can all determine what that is when you're buying your insurance. And the premium is a function of your coverage limits, deductible, claims history, how much you pay on an annual basis for your premiums. They look at your history over the previous 5 years to figure out how much they're charging you, the insurance companies. Claims must be reported promptly. This is important in the sense that if you get sued or someone calls you up and says, I'm going to bring a claim against you, if you fail, you as the architect who found out that somebody's coming after you, if you fail to call your insurance company, you wait not a month, but maybe you wait 6 months, maybe you wait 10 months, because you're like, I want to avoid it. You could be at risk of the insurance company denying you because they want to get involved right away and see if they can figure out what the defenses are and do discovery. So you need to promptly report. You need to tell your carrier about that. They're always going to write a letter back to you and say, we're denying coverage or reserving rights, and they're always going to say blah, blah, blah. But you, as the architect, have the obligation to inform them, hey, there could be a claim against me. And sometimes you have clients that don't want to tell because maybe they have another claim pending, and another one they don't want to have their loss ratio and their premiums go up. But the risk is, okay, maybe you pay a little bit more premiums, but the other side is you don't get any coverage. So while you may have had a bad year, and it's not your fault, maybe these claims are all bogus, tell your insurance carrier. Tell them right away when a claim comes. You don't want to be in a situation, and I've been in that situation many times, where the insurance company denies coverage, and then the party's in big trouble because they have to write the check themselves. The lawyer, traditionally, with architecture, architects and professional liability, the lawyer is actually hired by the insurance company. The insurance company pays my bills as opposed to my client. Now, it's a strange tripartite relationship. The owner or the architect pays the insurance company to give them insurance. They pay in premiums. The insurance company pays me to do the work. And I represent the client. I represent the architect. So it's this kind of triangle. And my duty first is to the architect, not the insurance company. So the insurance company may call me up and say, settle, 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 settle. But if I think we have a good case, I have to talk to my client first. and say, your carrier says you should settle, but here's where we think the case is, because I have the duty to represent my client, which is the architect, with the utmost zeal. Even though the party that's paying my bill wants me to do something different, I still represent the architect first. And architects, lawyers can get in trouble if they just listen to the insurance company. And they put the client potentially where they are at risk, and they don't actually do what the insurance company wants to do. Sometimes it goes the other way. The insurance company says, I don't want to settle, I don't want to pay, I don't want to pay. And the client's like, I just want this to go away. I don't want this risk. I just want this to go away. You have to follow what your client says, the architect, not the insurance company. And then I go back to the insurance company and I push them and say, we need to settle, settle, settle. And if they say no, then it becomes a whole mess and it's a coverage claim and more lawyers get involved. But that's how sometimes it can go. Sometimes the insurance company is going to give you the exact opposite of what is best for your client, and you always have to look to your client. So when you, and I'm saying that about me as a lawyer when I'm acting, when you are in a situation, if you as the architect are in a situation and you're not sure whose side your lawyer's on because you know they're getting paid, or you don't think that they're representing you to the utmost zealous because you think they're listening to the insurance company, know that I told you that they need to put you first, and you have to have a discussion with your attorney about that. So, practice policies versus project policies. So your typical architectural firm will carry a practice policy. So no matter what I do throughout the year, it's always there. I carry a $3 million policy, no matter what, it's always there. It's because I do a practice. That's what I do. And you determine how much you're going to carry in your limits is how big your projects are and what the risk value is and things like that. So if you're working on, you know, projects that are hundreds of millions of dollars, maybe you carry $5 million, maybe you carry $10 million. You have this practice policy, but it's in place for your practice. It doesn't apply to any individual project. That's a practice policy. The project policy is if you have a specific project where your practice policy is not enough. So I had a project where the architectural firm carried $5 million in practice in their practice policy. It was a $350 million project. But they didn't do many of those. So we needed $25 million in coverage because it was a big risk. And so we put into our contract with them that they needed to carry $25 million, and they said, well, we don't carry that. And so we said, okay, you need to buy a project policy that is specific to this project. It doesn't cover anything else but this project. So they got a $15 million rider that sat on top of their practice. So it wasn't actually $25 million specific. It was $15 for this project plus they had their own practice. They stacked it. Sometimes you'll have a situation where they'll buy only that $25 million policy, but you want to do that when the risks to the owner or the project are higher, and you get this project policy. When the project is over, it expires. No more premiums, it doesn't have to do anything. There may be a tail where it sits around for a couple more years, but that practice, that project policy only relates to things that happen on that very project.
So let's say the architect years later, they no longer have
this
project policy, but now they have enough coverage
in
the practice policy.
It's a great question. So the question was, if you get sued on a project, if there's a lawsuit on a project where there was a project policy with a higher value limit, but it's many years later, what if the project policy is gone? Then what's left is the practice policy. And so what you try to do with the project policy is that when you write a contract, you include language that says that there's a tail created. Tail meaning after the project's over, it hangs on. And even when people retire, like if I retire, and I've had architects that have retired, I advise them, continue to pay your insurance for the next 2 to 5 years so you potentially could get sued. So normally what will happen is the tail will be somewhere within that 2 to 4 years because of the statute of limitations for any policy. If you have a project policy, though, and you're looking at potential risks, then as the owner, because the owner's going to be paying for that additional insurance, the owner should then talk to their people, their own risk management people, and say, how long should this tail last? You would expect that a building that's complicated, that's up and running, would have gone through its kinks and figured out what's wrong with it traditionally over the first 3 to 5 years. So normally tails are going to be only that long. But sometimes you will have tails that last in the contract that says we will last to the end of the statute of limitations. So again, that's a decision that's made when you're looking at the complexity of the project, the risks that are there, ultimately the use of the project, those types of things, to protect yourself. But to your first part of your question, if there's a lawsuit and the tail has expired, but the architecture firm's still in place, they'll probably still have their practice policy. The claim would be made under the practice policy, so it would only be limited to, let's say, if the $5 million policy, it would only be limited because the $25 million has expired, and you can't recover on that. And so you hope that we're in a scenario where the damages are less, if you're the architect, less than the $5 million. So, that help? Okay. Let's see what else we have. Commercial general liability. Okay, this is the next type of insurance that's in every construction project. And there's going to be two different ways we're going to talk about it. For the architect, okay, this is purchased by the architect and it covers claims that are not arising out of or related to your design services. So, like, you have to make sure that you're acting properly on the project site. If you're walking around and you run into somebody and you injure them, you're not paying attention. Again, it's the same scenario. Instead of it's me walking on the street, it's the architect and they're looking at drawings and there's a hole there and I bump into an electrician and the electrician falls in the hole and breaks their leg. Well, that's not me acting as an architect. I'm walking on the project site. I'm acting negligently. That's when my commercial general liability policy will kick in because I'm not performing my architectural duties and actually just clumsy. Or if someone comes to my office in the winter and I haven't properly cleared the snow and they slip and fall, or maybe it's a carpet that's got a square up and they trip and fall on that. Commercial general liability, not the professional liability. Questions?
Would this be the thing that would cover...
Sorry, I should have asked you. I should have gotten you right with your raise your hand. Okay. So it's stuff that isn't related to... It's just like everybody's regular insurance. Like you have insurance for your, you know, like it's just normal insurance you may have. Like if you own a condo and people, or you own a house or whatever, and people come over, your homeowner's insurance protects somebody getting injured in your house. It's general. It's commercial general liability. It's just general liability insurance. That's what it covers. It doesn't relate to the architect's services. That's your errors and omissions policy.
You came back. You're ready.
Yeah, sure. I'm ready.
Would this be the one that covers, like, you driving to the job site?
No. But good question, because that's coming up in the next insurance. So we'll get there in a second. Such claims are rare in a construction project for an architect because, I mean, there may be that one scenario that I just said, I'm looking at drawings and I run into somebody and they fall into a pit. But normally when I'm on the project side as an architect, I'm performing my services as an architect, so that would fall into my professional liability. That commercial general liability is just your actions walking around elsewhere, or your running of your offices, or those types of things. You commit fraud. That may be something that's covered by your commercial general liability insurance unless there's an exclusion. There's those types of things that fall into it. So, because insurance responds to very few risks, it's not very expensive. So, like, the premiums are really low, the deductibles are low. I'm going to carry $1 million CGL, commercial general liability policy, and my deductible's $5,000. That $1 million for my professional liability, that deductible's $50,000 or $100,000. Big difference because it's rarely called upon. How many times do you go to your architecture's firm and you fall down and hit your head on a desk because they had a loose tile? Not very often. So it's not something that it's a low risk for the insurance company. But you've got to carry it because you don't want somebody injured and you have to write that check. So that's why it's low in cost. So... And it's always required. Like in every contract I ever write, I require them to carry professional liability, commercial general liability, and the one that's coming up. This is written on what's called an occurrence basis. Remember the last one with claims made? This one's an occurrence. So if the person came to my office and tripped on the front step because of the snow and ice in December of 25, but they don't get around to suing me until March of 26, it's the 25 policy that comes in because it's an occurrence-based policy. That's the difference between professional liability and commercial general liability. The other thing about it is, and I don't know if it's in this point, is that the value of it, it's not an eroding policy. So if it's $1 million and I have $1 million in damages, I get the full policy. The insurance company pays the lawyer, but that's in addition to that. So that factors into a little bit of the premiums, but it's not an eroding policy. The contractor side, it's the same concept. It's same, it's an occurrence base. It's same, it's not eroding and everything else. But for the contractor, it's the major source of their protection. The contractors don't have an errors or omissions policy because under insurance they're not considered professionals, even though they may be licensed contractors and all the other stuff. So when you sue an architect and a contractor, the two insurance policies, architect's going to look to their professional liability policy, contractor's going to look to their commercial general liability policy. The two different policies. So it even gets down to like that scenario. You're injured in December, you're sued in of 25, and you're sued in March of 26. The architect's using its 26 policy, the contractor's using its 25 policy, because the difference between the occurrence basis and claims made. The general contractor will name the owner and the architect as additional insured, meaning they also, the owner and the architect, also get protection from the contractor's policy. And that's common. If you ever do a renovation, let's say you own a home, and you ever hire a contractor to renovate your place or do some work, ask them for two things. One, I want to see that you have insurance. And two, I want you to name me as an additional insured on your policy. So if I get sued, not only can I bring you in for indemnity or contribution, but your insurance company is going to pay my lawyer's bills. You want their insurance as an additional insured. You're just like them. And they'll do it all the time. It's free. It's never a difference. Like, I've never had anybody say, no, I won't name you as additional insured. If you're not named, you've got to use your own insurance company. But if you are named, use the contractor's insurance company. Let me see if this is... don't need to go into this because I want to move along. This is about illusory coverage. This is when contracts and construction get insurance gets a little heavy. So, the policy covers claims alleging sudden and dangerous occurrences resulting in property damages, but not solely economic loss. So there's this concept called an economic loss in construction. I'll just mention it really quickly. Let's say, I'll use an example of a case. There was a condo complex that I had that the parapet wall where it met the roof was improper design, and they constructed it improperly. And as a result, water seeped down through the walls, went into the window frames, and then rusted those out, and it would seep into the unit owner's floors. So you had windows that needed to be replaced, the parapet wall that needed to be replaced, and the floors were buckling. Bad design, bad construction. So the Arizona omission policy kicked in a little bit, but this concept in Illinois called economic loss, because it wasn't sudden and, what do we call it here? Sudden and calamitous, happens right away. The commercial general liability policy didn't cover it. We had to prove that. Now, if a wall fell down, it would cover it because it's sudden and calamitous. If there's an explosion, it would cover that. So there's all these nuances about insurance. And again, there won't be anything on the test for this. We need to understand when your lawyer starts talking to you about what insurance you have and why you're covering it and why this could be covered, because that's going to be your biggest question. When you are an architect out there, and I hope nobody in this class ever gets sued. Luckily, none of my students ever have called me because they've been sued over the 14 years I teach, which is great. You guys all can call me. I've already told you that. You can call me if there's anything that comes in. You or your firm gets sued. Just call me and we'll figure it out. I can't say it's free the whole time, but the first call is I can do that. I have to talk to my firm. But anyway, none of them will call me that. They call me for other stuff. But if you are in a situation where you get sued, it's really confusing about what's covered and what's not covered. And it's nerve-wracking because your business could be on the line. And your lawyer is going to start going into the sudden calamitous and everything else, and it's very complex. So that's why you need a lawyer for insurance, and you need to make sure you get somebody. Because if you had to do it, and you had to work through this minefield, it would be very complex. I do construction law. I represent architects and engineers and owners and some specialty subcontractors. But when I get into a big, meaty insurance thing, I get my coverage lawyers involved. I know a lot of it, but it's so complex that I want them to make sure. I'm like, is my client covered here? What can I give them as advice? And so there's all this stuff that, again, you won't be testing it, but for the purposes of this, I just want you to take away, as I said, special liability, claims made, and eroding. Commercial general liability is occurrence-based and 100%. And the rest of it is really complex and hire your lawyer. That's what I want you to take away from that. Automobile liability, that's what covers the person that's in the car accident. And you want to have auto liability policy that covers your employees. So, they cover accidents arising out of the use of the car. It has to be when you're an architect in the course of them performing business. So if like I'm going home from work and I get in an accident, it's not covered. If I'm driving to work and get in an accident, not covered. If I'm driving to a project site for a specific visit, arguably covered. So, there's simply commercial versions of what you guys have. Anybody that drives around, has a driver's license, has insurance, it's just a commercial version of it. Maybe more coverage, maybe more language because it covers everybody that's working for the company, sort of stuff like that. But there's not much difference between the auto liability policy that a company carries and what you guys carry driving around every day. So, question back there. So the company that you're the hired vehicle that you're in should be covered. So the train, plane, or other automobile, they should carry their own insurance because you're not the driver. But let's say that your car has broken down and you hire an Uber to go to the project site and there's an accident that the Uber driver gets into. Can you, as the architect, be sued or your company be sued? The answer is probably yes. So the language of most commercial automobile policies say is hired or non-hired. Non-hired is I have my own car or it's a company car. Hired is I get into a cab or an Uber. So when that car accident happens and they sue us and the Uber company or Yellow Cab or whoever it is, you have coverage there. So that's traditional what you would put in there. It would be to the limits you carry. And normally you would say contribution, it's the Uber driver, like they are 95% at fault unless I'm screaming in their ears going, turn left, turn left. You shouldn't have liability, but just in case, you want to carry hired and non-hired, and that's traditional language. So, builder's risk. So I'll go through this really quickly. I'm going to put all these up here. Builder's risk is this gap policy. So let's say, because remember we've been talking about negligence and standard of care. Let's say something happens on your project site while the construction's going on. Architect didn't commit any design malpractice. The building was designed properly. Contractor built it exactly the way it was drawn. Contractor didn't do any construction negligence. The building gets hit by fire, by a lightning bolt, or there's vandalism, or there's an explosion because of something. Who knows? These happen on construction projects. Now you have this loss. I can't sue the contractor because they were negligent. Can't sue the architects because they were negligent. I'm down potentially millions or hundreds of millions of dollars because my building burned to the ground. Builder's risk is the insurance. It covers that gap when nobody's at fault. It is a no-fault type of insurance. It covers acts of God. It covers vandalism. It covers theft. It covers somebody that's acting that's outside the control of the owner or the contractor. One of my partners had a project up in Canada. It was a huge power plant that they were building, and there was a collapse due to high winds. And it was actually, there was a lawsuit against the contractor because, and the architect, of whether the facility was designed properly. But it was a $250 million loss. It was actually, and there was two or three people that were killed. It was a really tragic accident, and then they had to rebuild the facility. It was all covered by builder's risk because it turned out that it was the high winds. It was an act of God. Neither party, the architect nor the contractor, was at fault. So you have to have this middle gap coverage. That's what you want to take away from builder's risk. It's nobody's at fault, but we still are steering the construction of the project. When the project is completed, when you turn the keys of the building over to the owner, the builder's risk insurance stops. And then your other insurance policies kick in later. So if it gets hit by lightning the day after you turn the keys over, the owner's property insurance as opposed to the builder's risk. So it has a very limited span, but that's what it covers, that gap between while the construction's going on. And sometimes the owner buys it, sometimes the contractor buys it. Normally it's what's cheaper, because it's always going to be paying out for nobody's fault. So that's kind of how you look at it for that. Anything on that? I don't know that answer for sure, but I would argue that that is on final completion. So substantial, because you can occupy a building. Buildings sometimes have multiple substantial completion dates. Contracts will say you're allowed to occupy spaces that are completed. So it certainly wouldn't be an occupancy. And between substantial completion and final completion, the contractor's still doing punch list items and all these other things to finish it out. So normally I have to go back and look, but my guess is it's going to be a final completion of when the last check is paid and everything's cleared out. So, danger to an architect is the builder's risk may pay off a loss and then turn around and sue the architect for having negligently contributed to the problem. So that's like, wait a minute, didn't you say that this is, doesn't have to be a risk? That there's no, this is no fault? Well, sometimes, though, with builder's risk, the insurance company may say, we're going to pay it off because I supplied builder's risk to the owner and contractor. That's who the builder's risk is between, the owner and contractor. But I think the architect who wasn't involved in this dispute, I think the architect did something wrong. So after the builder or the insurance company pays me, the owner, for my losses, they have subrogated. Subrogation is where they take and stand in your shoes. They've subrogated the rights, and then they may come back and sue an architect. So there's a risk there. It doesn't happen often. I've only been in a few cases where the architect has been involved in a builder's risk subrogation case, but it sits out there. So, I talk about subrogated the owner's and possibly the contractor's rights against the architect. So they step into the shoes of the owner. They say, okay, I'm an insurance company. I paid the owner off. Owner, let me see your contract with the architect. I become you, and I'm going to sue the architect. So what do you do for that as an architect? What you do, and this is again, you don't have to worry about this on a test, but I want you to understand this as an architect when you're out there. You make sure your contract has what's called a waiver of subrogation that stops the insurance company from stepping in your shoes. Because who wants to battle against billion-dollar insurance companies? So every single one of your projects, every single one, needs to have a waiver of subrogation. Every single one needs to have that clause that says you can't indemnify somebody else with a no negligence. Those are two clauses you have to have in every one of your contracts. They're common in every construction contract, so people are not going to say, oh my God, what are you asking for? You want a waiver of subrogation, you want, I don't have to indemnify you for your own negligence, a couple other provisions, but those are ones you always need to have in there. That's the one takeaway from this part of this. See what else we have. Now the last one here, I believe, we have is workers' comp. I'll go through this really quickly so we can get you guys out of here because it's quarter of. I apologize, this went longer. Workers' comp has to deal with the employer and the employee only. So I'm working on a project site and either I get knocked down into a pit or I fall off a ladder or what have you. I'm a worker and I've been injured. By law, every state requires an employer to carry workers' compensation. It could be you're injured while you're at the office. I had a lawsuit where a woman sued on her workers' comp because the lights that were, and I got brought in because we were the architect, the lighting fixtures, she said, and there were fluorescent lights that had these kind of parabloom lavaliers in it with reflective surfaces. They said that it activated her lupus, and as a result, she had more problems, and so she sued us. As the architect, we were at risk for the whole dollar damages, but she also sued her employer under workers' comp. So you could always sue your employer, but the workers' comp law says it's limited to a certain value. And they have these tables. If you lost a finger, there's a table that says how much that finger's worth. If you lost the use of your arm, there's a table that says loss of use of arm versus loss of the entire arm. There's literally tables that you see. And so if you have an injury, the workers' comp will come in and it'll go through and say what those values are. So you will get recovery from your employer. But then remember earlier on when I said there could be two or more people at cause of a fault and recovery damages, that worker can sue the contractor, the worker can sue the owner, and they can sue them after that. They get their money from their employer, but they also can get more money from the other people. Question back there. There's actuary tables, there's this group of people, I don't know who they are. I haven't done workers' comp in 30 years. I did comp when I first got out for a little bit of time. It's plug and chug, it's kind of the meat grinder stuff. And I remember going over to, there's a specific, if you don't even go to like regular courtroom, that used to be at State of Illinois building, but they're now, isn't that could be what, Google now or whatever it is? So when that was still a government building, we would go over there for workers' comp hearings, and it was like I said, it was like a meat grinder. There's all these people, and it's terrible because there's people that are injured and everything else, and some of these people, it's there for the right reason. Some of these people don't have enough money or understanding to hire a lawyer, and so they may have lost the use of their arm, and the only thing they can get is their money from a table through the workers' comp insurance that their company carries. They don't know that they could sue somebody else or they don't have the time. So I'm some directive of it because it's plug and chug. It's not the greatest glamorous law and everything else. But it does serve its purpose, and that's why it's created. But I don't know who the people that create the dollars, but it's there. So that's all you need to know about comp. We don't have to go into more of that. And then a certificate of insurance. So when you have a project that the contract says you've got to carry this type of insurance. And I'll show you those provisions in the B101 next week where it says it's in Article 2, you need to carry this insurance. So all the insurance I just talked about is all in that contract. I need to prove to the owner I got it. So I get what's called a certificate of insurance. It's like one page of paper. And it's got from your broker, and it's got the name of the insurance company. It says commercial general liability, $1 million. Professional liability, $3 million. Workers' comp, $500,000, which is statutory. Maybe there's an umbrella. There's all this other. So it says exactly what insurance you're carrying. It's just like it's your sheet. It says, hey, I got the insurance. It's proof I have it. It's in place. That's normally going to be asked for on a project. You normally don't get the actual full insurance policy. There's arguments whether it's privileged or not. The only time you really need that full insurance policy is if something goes wrong and there's a lawsuit later. So certificates of insurance is what you want to do. The one thing here that probably is important for your duties is it's often said in the contract that the architect is responsible for collecting all the certificates of insurance from everybody, not just from their subcontractors, some consultants like their mechanical engineer and electrical engineer. The architect has to get the certificate from the contractor, from the electrician, from the woodworker, from the plumber, all these people. So they're the keeper of records. That's the job that you and the architect do. And then that's it. So this one I didn't get you out at 11, but it's before 12. So any other questions? Like I said, the takeaway from this is the most thing you want to pay attention to is that first part all on the standard of care, breach, negligence stuff. That's where the questions are going to come from the exam mostly. Maybe the basic question on the third-party concept for the indemnity, and as far as the insurance, it may be like what type of insurance you would cover for this type of situation. Not, you know, tell me about the derivative liability of blah, blah, blah. I'm not going to ask that. So, all right? Have a nice weekend, guys. Thank you. And I'll send around early next week the D101 for you guys just to glance at. So, and I, for next week I will start like right at 9 because it's very fast.